Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Carpcast, where we look back at one of the extras from about 2.5 years ago. For those of you that have never described, if you don't know what the extras are, it's unreleased content only released on our website, or now for iPhone users, we'll give you a link to a Dropbox, which means you can download them to your phone, because at Apple do not like you downloading audio files to your phone. It's all part of their iTunes protection. You've got no problem if you have Windows or Android, because you can download direct from our site to the phone. But to get around Apple's annoying fault, we've set up a Dropbox. All you have to do, if you already have an extra account, or if you join the extra and you have an iPhone, then email Reese, contact him on the website, or through Facebook Messenger, Carpcast, one of the Carpcast fan pages, or the main Carpcast page, and Reese will send you an email invite to this particular Dropbox, where all the extras will already be in there for you, and it makes it super easy to get access to it on your phone. You can either stream it or just download them to your Dropbox, and they're there forever. Thanks, Reese, for sorting that out. There's a brand new website up and running at the minute as well, the same address, www.thecarpcast.com. If you have been an extra member on the old one, then I think you need to reset your password. Reese is putting instructions again in the official Carpcast page. But all singing, all dancing, new website. And ready for this year. We're fired up for lots and lots of Carpcasts this year. And the only reason we're putting this one out is because, unfortunately, there haven't been a Carpcast for the last 3 weeks. That's because it's show season. We've got the NAS show coming up this weekend, which is looking absolutely fantastic. The guests we've got on all three stages are immense. We've got Jeremy Wade there from River Monsters, finally. Scott Maslin is there, the EastEnders actor who's just absolutely addicted to carp fishing. Tons and tons of others, but one thing we have got is the Carpcast Theatre. We've got Scott Lloyd on in there. We've got Danny Fairbrass on in there. John Max doing a bit in the rig lab. Julian Hundiff's hosting the rig clinic, and we've got Joe Turnbull hosting the bait clinic. They've got guests both days. There's probably about 30 name anglers talking between the three areas, from the Carpcast Theatre, the rig lab, the bait lab, and the main stage. It's by far the best lineup we've ever had at the Northern Angling Show, and that is next weekend, as I record this on Saturday the 17th. It's the following week, the 24th and 25th of Feb. northernanglingshow.co.uk to get tickets, or you can pay on the door at Event City in Manchester. It's going to be fantastic. But going back to the extras, I'm going to run a competition for existing extra members, and anybody that signs up between now and when I move across to Slovenia to run the fishing trips this year. We're doing Croatia and Slovenia fishing trips, and what I'm going to do, I'm going to take two Carpcast members with me to probably the Croatia lake the coming September, October. So in roughly 6 months' time, I'm going to give a holiday for two people over there, absolutely free. We're just going to do a random draw from the extra members. So you've got time to join. You've got the next few weeks to become a member of the extra, and you can win yourself a free holiday. Extra membership is from as little as £2.92 a month. That's if you sign up for 1 year, which is 35 quid. Works out at under £3 a month. Or there are quarterly and 6 month subscriptions as well. I think the quarterly one's £11.99 per quarter. We are building a skills library. The first two series of the extras is about 30 hours of content, very similar to what we're about to play out now. So the extra that you're going to hear, which is absolutely packed full of guests. We've got people like John Mack, Kevin Nash, Daryl Peck, Frank Warwick, Ronnie DeGrota, famous Belgium angler, all telling stories. And that's how the first two series of the extra were. It's just stories from really well-known anglers with topics that Mark and I gave the guests. This particular one, I think we're doing the one that got away, and we're also doing scary stories. And let me tell you, there's some absolute crackers coming up here. Series 3, which we have started now, we've done 3 episodes of season 3, and we're doing the skills library. So hopefully it's a library of stuff you can keep in your Dropbox or on your phone, and if you ever need it, or if you ever want some advice from not just Mark and I, it's from some famous anglers as well. We've had a floater fishing one where we've got one of the best floater and stalking anglers out there, Alan Blair, contributing to that one. We did one on watercraft, and we've got a number of people talking about watercraft, from Daryl Peck to John Mack, myself, and Scott Lloyd as well, who's obviously fantastic. And we've done one on boat fishing as well. If you ever find yourself going abroad needing to use a boat, or maybe you join one of the UK syndicates that allows boats, then there's some absolutely invaluable information in that one there again. And again, Scott Lloyd contributes to that one. He's done a lot of boat fishing on the likes of Stone Acres. I think the next one we're going to do is rigs. We're going to do an advanced rigs one as well. We're going to do one on technology, so sort of bait boats, drones, using echo sounders, that sort of thing. So the plan is to build up around 10 episodes of just individual skills that are going to help you, you know, catch more fish or be more proficient on the bank. So yeah, if you'd like to join the Carpcast Extra, you can do that on the brand new website. Shout out to Rhys, www.thecarpcast.com. It's a much simple, clearer method, and as I said, we've got round the problem for extra users with our Dropbox account, and you need to email Rhys. Contact him with your own email, the one that you use to sign up, and you can win a holiday. I'm going to take two Carpcast listeners over to Croatia in September, October this year. All you have to pay is your flights and transport to get over there, and then a bit of money for food and some bait while you're out there. The rest, everything else will be free. Get yourself signed up, and I'm hoping you'll want to sign up as soon as you've listened to this. So without further ado, let's let Mark and I take over. Hello and welcome to the Carpcast Extra 2. I'd like to thank all you subscribers that are listening to this. There's been quite a few of you now. They're creeping up slowly. And as we said in Carpcast Extra 1, we're going to treat you people. We'll make sure you hear all the latest info about the Carpcast first. Get access to the socials. And anything else we can do for you, we will be doing to our loyal members first. How you doing, Mark?
Ah, fabulous. I'm just grateful for all the subscribers we have got. And, you know, when you do, you know, you put about a free podcast, you know, we just do it. We dove right into it. But when we're doing this extra, I don't know about you, but I've had this feeling where you kind of feel a bit more responsibility because people are actually paying you. But the feedback we've had has been brilliant.
Yeah, we did put a lot of effort into the last one, and it does take a lot of editing because the structure that we've done it, we've got an in session coming up, which we'll go to very shortly, and we've got lots of different well-known anglers all giving their stories on certain questions that we ask them. And we'll do two questions each one. What do you fancy this week, Mark? I think we should do one slightly educational one, and one really storified, entertaining one.
Yeah, I was thinking entertaining, amusing.
Yeah, certainly. I reckon like we did Greatest Achievement last time, and maybe like what about the one that got away? Everyone's got a good.
I was just going to say that one. We've all lost fish. Something everyone can relate to that.
Yeah. So we'll do the one that got away. And for the other one, any ideas? I bet you can't even remember the ones that we did, can you?
I can remember a couple, and having come straight from the mega successful Northern Angling show, we listened to some of Frank's injury stories and spooky tough stories, so one of those.
We should either do injury or scary story. You pick one. I'll let you pick. Either injury or scary. Do the one that got away and whichever your choice is.
Let's go for the scary stories. Let's see what's given people the willies.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to that just shortly. Right now, let's check in on our in-session feature. Let's check in on one of my sessions.
In-session.
Set the scene. I'm fishing. It's January. It's cold. And I'm with my friend Paul Bacon, or Roger Bacon as he's known in the fishing world.
Howdy.
And it's a bit of a special one. These occasions don't happen very often in fishing. So to set the scene, we've been given some information on a lake by a friend of ours. We can say his name, I guess, can't
we? Yeah.
John Harrop.
Not that you'll mind.
It's a guy that's got in touch with us through the carp cast. He lives near me. We got friendly. He's a very keen angler that keeps his ear to the ground, and he's discovered a lake. We're not going to tell you where it is because it's something a bit special. Some of them things that in my lifetime, fishing lifetime of 30 years of fishing from a young age, you don't get the opportunity very often to turn up to a lake where A is a bit of the unknown, B seems to have a reasonable stock of above average size fish, C has got rumours of potentially really big fish, maybe 50 pound plus, and D, nobody's fishing. Like, it just doesn't happen. You normally have to put your name on waiting lists for years on end, and I know Roger's pretty good at finding lakes and, putting his name on the list way before me. And he tends to get offered these tickets. But again, you're still kind of in the rat race with everybody else. And to have an opportunity to catch, maybe special fish where you're pretty much left alone, you against the fish rather than you against other anglers, it doesn't happen very often.
No, not at all. I mean, I've probably got my name on probably 10 waiting lists at the minute, and even then you're gonna be waiting 3-5 years even more for some, so when something just drops on your lap, and even if you don't really you can't really believe what you're being told, it's always worth investigating. So that's how we find ourselves here, really, isn't it?
Last time you put me onto a lake, I had nowhere to fish, and it was about 12 years ago, and it was a lake called Colmere in Shropshire. And I had absolutely nothing to lose. There was a handful of rumours in a very large lake, and they proved to be true. And, I ended up catching a very special fish from there, the Banana Common. And, these fish aren't as wild as maybe those fish were. These fish in this particular lake have definitely been stocked. But they seem to be big. The average size is pretty decent. John fished here a couple of weeks ago. Bear in mind, it's January, it's winter, and we've got permission to fish here till the end of March. And then that's it, we can only do a couple of winter sessions. So, but John had a handful of 30s and a 40 last week, which is unreal. That's a season's worth of fish for me in a normal season, fishing a low stock lake. So to tell you a bit about the lake, it's about, how big would you say it was, 5 acres, 6 acres?
Yeah, it's certainly no more than 6. Yeah.
It's rectangular shaped. It's shallow. I would say the average depth is 5 foot. Very slightly deeper in places. I'd think you'd struggle to find anywhere deeper than 6 foot, and there's definitely 3.5-4 foot at one end. One end seems to be deeper than the other. The shallower end seems to be sort of harder, more gravelly bottom. And the deeper end, I think it's clay. Like, it feels soft everywhere you land, and it looks like it gets extremely weedy in the summer. There's a thin layer of, is it siltweed, would you say?
Yeah, definitely. Siltweed, candy floss stuff.
On the bottom, like everywhere you cast. But the fish don't show. The people we know that have fished it, a few people got permission to fish it, and nobody's reported seeing fish. And yet people have been catching fish. and nobody's seen any. And you know, that's what I've been told. And Roger's got an eagle eye, haven't you? Yeah, you normally see everything.
Well, I mean, it does look like, you know, obviously the amount of bites that we've had in the nights we've fished. I've already done one session before this one that Jamie's joined us on, and I'd you know, four bites there, and we've had quite a lot of bites this time. There's obviously quite a few fish in the lake, and I've literally been looking hard most days I've fished, and I've seen one fish, and even that was not a fish. I've seen a dark shape go down in one corner, looked hard into that corner for the next sort of 15 minutes. There was no birds there, so it was a fish. But in general they just do not show, and it's you come across these lakes, don't you, really, every now and then.
Yeah, I've only ever fished a couple of lakes where they actually don't show. When people tell me fish don't show, I normally think you're just not looking. And I'm not the best watcher. When I'm really tuned in, I do. But watching fish is a skill in itself. Like, because you can think you're watching, and you can think you're sitting watching all day for like 8 hours, but actually you're bending down to make a brew, to get something out, you know, some biscuits out your bag at the back. And are you actually truly scanning hard for the day? Now, I've done it where I think I've watched all morning, and Roger's walked into my peg, and I'm like, nothing showing, it's dead. And he's like, there's one, and sees one straight away. And your famous saying to me is, do you think that's the first one that's shown in your swim all morning, just as I happen to walk in the peg?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some people, like you say, some people think that they look for fish. You know, and it's not really, I don't think, until you get experienced fishing on the big waters, very low stock, when it really is paramount that you locate carp, it's then that you really truly learn how to look for fish properly.
Definitely. So back to this, like, when people tell me fish don't show, like, I pretty much disregard it until three or four people that I trust, that I know are good watchers of the lake, and my own eyes, like, confirm it. Otherwise I think, no, you're wrong, like, fish do show. Either you weren't on them, or you weren't looking hard enough. But this is truly a lake where I think they don't show. So we're sat here with a Budweiser in our hand.
I'll have one just to the side of you.
We might as well crack them open. You can probably hear the chink of the bottles. Like, so we're on the session now. I've arrived at the lake. We've got limited knowledge, except, you know, rumoured to be big fish. The average size of the fish that's been caught, because it's only really been fish this winter, the average size of the fish that's been caught has been impressive. There's been a number of 30s caught with a fish to 40 that John had. And, you know, he's telling me stories of other 40 pluses, possibly 50s. So obviously it sounds too good to be true, so, you know, while not casting aspersions on what anyone tells me, it's one of them where in the fishing game you wait and see, you know, what your own eyes tell you. I've had people tell me there's certain fish in certain lakes, and the lake gets caught, the fish gets caught from the lake next door, you know, and they're telling me, I've seen it in the edge, I've seen it feeding, like, and all of a sudden it gets caught from another lake next door, and you're like, well, really? When did you see it? Because it weren't even in there. So, like, you always have to kind of read things as what you see with your own eyes, but there is plenty of fish getting caught, and the average size is decent, so the signs are promising that there could be something really special in there. And to be honest, if I ended up catching a few 30s and a 40 between now and March, I mean, that's the season's fishing for me on most lakes, so it would be an amazing success. So we've arrived at the lake with kind of this much knowledge. Roger came here, was it last week or the week before?
Yeah, I've already done, when John invited us both down, a couple of weeks back now, wasn't it? You couldn't make it, so I still came. And as you say, you know, you just don't know what, you know, John's a sound guy, and I did believe what he was telling us about the lake. But not until that first session, the first night of the first session for me, I had two bites, both of them were 30-pounders. I had a scrape of 30 and a 34. It's pretty obvious then that, you know, that the fish that he was saying were in the lake were definitely in here. Since then I came back, that was last week, it was a real cold night overnight. I got frozen on one night, woke up in the morning, the lake had a lid on it, packed up and came home. So I've literally fished two nights, been frozen for one night, and since then, obviously, me and Jamie have just come back this session, haven't we?
Yeah, so signs are promising. It looks like there's enough fish here to make us smile between now and the end of March anyway, regardless of what else happens. So I set up in the peg that John and his friends have been having fish from, and Rod set up in the peg that he had a couple of fish from, them 30s, on his first session. Finding spots was a little bit... it's shallow, so I'm used to like casting out, you know, waiting for the drop on the lead and feeling the bottom and being able to ascertain what the bottom is by the feel of it. When you cast into like 4 or 5 foot that's got weed on the bottom anyway, like, you're just not feeling anything. It's very hard to get a drop anywhere. For me, it feels like I'm fishing blind. Like, it, I didn't have a lot of confidence at the start. And the first night that I fished, which was Sunday night we got here, I just didn't feel like I was angling. I had 3 rods out, and I wasn't really happy with any of them. I knew I was in the areas where John's had fish, but I don't know, I just didn't feel right. And then, right on dark, Roger gets a take. In fact, just before dark, and he's in a peg that obviously he's fished twice before. He got frozen once, and the time before he had a couple of bites. I think he had 3 and landed 2, didn't he?
Yeah,
the 230s.
Right. Yeah.
So, like, he's kind of already 2 sessions ahead of learning the spots, feeling the bottom and stuff. And then he gets a bite, like, before dark. And he's also learned that all his bites have been at night, in the middle of the night in this peg. So it's a really encouraging sign for him to get a bite, like, kind of before it even got dark. You know, first thing he said was, that's a good sign for this peg.
Yeah, I think all the fish that I've had in early have been, they've been after midnight. It's been a real night peg. I've really tried to try and develop the peg and get a bite in the daytime. You know, I've been up in the mornings, I've rebaited, I've got my rods out, the conditions have looked right. I thought, surely, you know, if I just leave my rods now, I might be able to induce a bite for the daytime, but it's just not happened. So when that bite came quite early on, what time was it? It was about...
Five, six-ish.
So
early.
Yeah, it was early. It was well early. I thought, oh, well, that's obviously an excellent sign. It's quite an easy area where I'm fishing. You know, straight out. It's straight out in front. Got it all wrapped up. So I can't remember how big was that fish. It was a small one, wasn't it?
It was quite small.
It was actually the first of 4 small fish that night. I went on to catch 4 fish that night, and they were all 18 to 20 pound. But it was still a result. You know, first night, 4 fish, you know, start middle of January. Happy days, but you were sort of thinking, oh God, you know.
Well, I didn't. I had a couple of small beat. I think I had 1 liner on my middle rod. I had 2 rods in short, maybe 25, 30 yards on like a clearish area that I could actually get a pull with my lead on. I had 1 rod out a bit longer, and I don't know, I didn't feel like I deserved a fish. And then Roger gets like 4 bites overnight, so, you know, every couple of hours I'm getting woke up, like, I've got another one, take a picture. And in the end, I think he took a picture on the floor the last 2 rather than wake me up.
Didn't want to wake
you up. So I've woke up in the morning feeling pretty deflated. You know, yes, I know it's... You know, I didn't feel like I'd angled. I didn't think I'd deserved a fish anyway. It would have had to have been super easy for me to catch on that first night.
In session. So we're going to continue on with the in session. There's quite a few parts to this one, and we'll carry on with that in a little bit. I'm going to do a listener's question or two in this one. I believe you've recorded somebody for this, haven't you, Mark?
Well, I recorded my mate Scott as he popped into the shop at work today, but unless I find it and send you it, we'll just have to read his question out.
The joys of modern technology, eh?
Yeah, well, the joys of modern technology in the hands of a complete muppet.
We're going to go on to the one that got away stories, I think, first. Have you got any stories first? Can you think of one that really stung?
Oh, yeah, big time.
Go on.
It's one that you caught as well.
Okay.
I hesitate because we talk about Pit 2 on this podcast hell of a lot, but imagine this, sweltering hot, you know, we're talking 30 degrees summer.
Elstow Pit 2, this is, in Bedfordshire.
Pit 2, yeah. And the back bay, you're casting, well, I had 1 rod out towards the open, but the 2 rods were cast tight to like a V in some Norfolk reeds. And actually lost two this session. You know, the first one, it was didn't feel like a massive fish, didn't have it on long and hook pulled, which that's bad enough. The last final morning of the session, I'm locked up, and that locked up didn't matter. You know, it was like, you know, beep, 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 beep. There was line coming off the reel. I picked the rod up, and I'm a big lump of humanity. It pulled me off balance, actually. Took a couple of steps forward, and I knew there was something mental on the other end. And honestly, it felt like the rod was going to snap or something. So I just slackened the clutch off, thought, right, get in those reeds, get yourself, you know, snagged up, and I'm coming for you. I went for a swim. I pulled my hook out of a reed stem.
Oh, nothing worse is when you're fishing near reeds.
No, that's it's not the end of the story. I believe your mate Eddie was there as well as I got out the lake, looking rather, you know, showing off my milk bottle-esque tan. But I say later that day, it probably wasn't that much later, but, you know, all the lake stock, they're out in the middle. You know, you could see the, you know, it's flat calm, but you could see the, you know, dorsal sticking up and the little bow waves as they soaked in the sun. All apart from one fish. You could see it from the walkway around the back of the reeds. It wasn't on the surface, it wasn't basking, it was sulking about a foot off the bottom. I saw every scale of the mother sat there.
Oh, it's even worse when you see them.
You can never be 100% sure, obviously, but all the evidence points to me.
Yeah, it's
being beat up by that fish.
When you know, I mean, you know the areas on lakes where fish go and sulk when they've been caught or lost, as it were. I saw the same thing on Yateley. Like, on Yateley, you could see most of the lake from the... There's some really tall climbing trees on there, like, where you can get, you know, 50, 60 foot plus up in the air. And, you know, on the warm days, you could see all the fish, you know, by doing a lap of the lake. You could see them wherever they were. And everybody, you know, they'd get in the habit of, like, wherever the most weed was, maybe, if they got lost or if one got caught. Let's say single scale got caught. And then you'd see it for like the next 4 or 5 days in a row, just in one area of the weed. Like, you could clearly sulking and not moving. And likewise, so obviously you know where they're going when they're sulking. And likewise, if somebody lost one, like, quite often a fish would turn up in that same area and sulk. Or they used to sulk in Gate Corner a lot as well, I think, when they got caught, which is like right in the car park on Yateley. And people used to go in, look in there. If somebody lost a fish, you'd go look in there, and you can see if they're visibly disturbed or just acting differently. They're not acting. You can see fish in the water, can't you, when they look comfortable and when they look happy. And quite often, fish that look happy, they're going to get caught. By happy, I mean, you know, they're swimming around, look like they're actively looking for food. I see it with our cat. Like, our cat's quite old and a bit lazy. And sometimes it's just got that look in its eye where it's up, you know, if you dangle something in front of it, it'll try and eat you. And, like, the rest of the time, it's just not interested. Like, you can see the difference just by looking in its eyes. And I've seen that with fish as well. Like, you can see the happy ones, and it's the happy ones that get caught, you know, the ones that are, you know, actively grubbing around for food. And you see it a lot when you're stalking, don't you? You know, you can see when the fish look happy. That's the only way I can describe it. It's hard to put into words what I'm thinking. But likewise, you can see when they're not happy, usually when they've been lost or when they've been caught. And big fish do sulk for a while, don't they? You know, and they do have areas they go and sulk in as well.
Certain ones, definitely, but we aren't about feeling happy. I'm not sure happy is the right word, but comfortable may be better. The fat lady was a prime example. As soon as that fish started showing regularly, you know someone was going to be holding her up for a picture within a week or so.
I've seen, the Conningbrook fish used to be like that as well. You know, a number of big fish I've seen, it's like they're getting closer and closer to getting caught. You know, they start poking the nose out and then they're coming up to the gill, and, you know, within a week or two, they're launching clear of the water and someone's going to catch it that week. And I've seen that so many times.
Here's a question for you. On the Woolpack, how many times did you see paddle in the water?
Not much. A couple of times.
Yeah, for such a small, intimate lake, and you could generally see a lot of the stock a lot of the time, I only saw it once, and that was you know, the week before Mick Henderson caught her.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was looking at her thinking, how the hell do you miss that? It's like a railway sleeper.
Yeah, it was a big old chunk, that one. I'd love to have caught that fish. a little bit gutted. That's one of the ones that got away for me. You know, there's when I was there.
I lost that one as well.
Did you?
It was either that or Cluster.
Oh.
But a couple of weeks after I had a loss, didn't get a full enough sight, but it just that heavy, heavy feeling. You know, when it turns and it just takes forever to come back to you.
Yeah.
And again, my own fault as well. Yeah, I've been messing around with hooks instead of. I just started using twisters, and I went back to a different long shank pattern and got the hook pull. But it was about a week or two before Jim Shelley caught paddle, and he took great delight in telling me there was a massive tear in its mouth.
Nothing worse is when you lose a good fish and then someone else catches it a few days later, and it's, you know, the fish has clearly been lost. And on the, you know, it's like on syndicate fishing, everybody knows who's hooked and lost fish. You know, on most syndicates, people know what regulars have been on that week. And, you know, if someone, especially low stock lakes, if somebody gets a bite, everybody knows whether it was landed or not. And, you know, if there's been one bite out in the last 2 weeks, and it's you and you've lost a fish, and then a fish gets caught a week later and it's got a fresh tear in its mouth, and you know that's the fish that you lost. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. You know, you're hoping it's one of the 20s, but quite often if it's the big one.
I only lose tench. I try and convince myself of that, but
which well-known angler would you like to hear their tale of the one that got away?
I'm going to be a bit self-indulgent here, because I've really enjoyed listening to Kev Nash on the last podcast. It wasn't, not last one, one before, wasn't it? But
yeah.
I just love his stories. He's been around forever. I've got a lot of respect for the man, so get him on.
The fish that sting the most, I guess, are the ones we don't catch. I mean, there must be one memory that sticks in your mind, that one fish that if you could have it back again, you would have liked to have not seen get away.
Oh, there's a few, Jamie, you know, especially losing the snake pit common. But I think the one that sticks in my mind, because it was so epic at the time, was I'd been trying to catch the Emperor. This is the first time. And after a year and a half, I finally hooked it. It's gone roaring out to the island. Stopped it at the reeds, and out the corner of my eye I saw something white, and this swan has flown in. It's hit the line 8-10 foot in front of the Emperor and got tangled up in it. You know, the swan's pulling one way, the Emperor's pulling the other way. There's foam and spray, you know, going up 15-20 feet. Yeah, you know, there's feathers flying everywhere. They're both having a right ruck with each other, and then the hook pulled. You know, I got the bloody swan but not the Emperor. But I remember coming back and I was well pissed.
Swans are not always an angler's best friend at the best of times, and that's because they're knocking our rods off or going through the line. But
I can... the most useless thing on this planet. Why the Queen wants to keep them all, I just do not understand. They are aggressive, nasty. There's just nothing nice to say about them. No. We've got on the lakes, and I'm actually going to fence the islands this year to stop them breeding, because all they do is just shit all over the banks, and there's feathers everywhere. They are bloody useless things. I'll tell you a story, right? We had a real aggressive male come in one year. Shot him in the nook, I'm not allowed to say that. I was up there on the church, and this mallard come on the lake with 12 chicks, right? It's roared across the lake, smashed into the mother and the chicks, killed all the chicks. It pursued the mother into the corner of the reeds and chased her for 15 minutes until it grabbed her around the neck. And I saw it shake that manard's neck and broke a neck just like a tear of a rat.
Yeah,
that thing was even attacking the carp when it was on the surface. Yeah.
I'm glad your opinion of the swans is similar to mine. But Fritz Acosta is a fish of a lifetime. That Empress been one of the best fish in the country for 15 years nearly, I would say.
I caught it later.
I've seen the pictures. That was an iconic picture on the front of your catalogue for 1 year. Yeah, the swan that got away.
No, the swan didn't get away.
The swan that should have got away.
I'm a One thing about swans, you know, everyone thinks they're ferocious, you know, and they break people's arms. You know. They're absolute softies, you know, you just grab them by the neck and then the wings are flapping, you wrap them under your arms and then you know, you've got them sorted. I was driving home from work one day when I lived in the country and I used to drive down the side of the reservoir, Hennington Reservoir. Mm-hmm. There's a big queue of traffic, I can't believe it. I used to see about 5 cars an hour and I've waited and waited. And then I've got out and walked 50 yards to the front, there's a police car there. And I said, yeah, what's up? And they pointed down the road, there's two swans sitting in the road. Yeah, it had been raining and they've mistaken it for a canal. I said, well, how long have you been waiting? You know, there's a WPC, she said, I've been waiting an hour. I said, why? She said, we're waiting for the RSPCA to come out. I said, you're having a laugh, I want to get home. I said, you want me to sort them for you? I said, I'll grab them and chuck them back in me high ace and take them home. And said, oh, would you? And she couldn't believe it. So I just walked up to him, grabbed him around the neck, wrapped my wings under my arm, threw him in the back of the truck. They were so easy to control, but people are frightened of flipping things.
Yeah, then did they actually go where they meant to, or did they end up in a skip somewhere?
They couldn't, because this guy came around my house, but he taught me something. You can actually carry two, because when you pin their wings, you know, under your arm, you then just get their head and stick it back under your arm so it's facing, you know, towards their arse. Yeah, and so you had one under each arm.
Tip, if you ever need to carry two swans, I'll edit that bit out, don't worry.
That's a killer. Losing a fish because of our own error or snags or weed, that's one thing. Losing it because a swan's gone into your line, you'd never look at a swan the same again, would you?
No, you'd look at it with the eyes of hatred.
Maybe the anti-carps were watching over the Cops Lake that day. I don't know. Oh dear.
The swan is the queen's bird. I think she should come and get all the sods.
Yeah,
take them home.
She can have them. Let's check back in on the on my session.
In session.
I remember Kev Hewitt in the interview Mark did with him on the main carp cast not too long back, and he kind of reminded me of how I used to fish when I was super keen. So I would mess a peg up, mess a chance of catching fish up, just to make sure I knew the bottom of the lake, like every spot in my whole peg. You know, I couldn't settle on a spot that was okay, thinking, well, I haven't plumbed extensively over there, there might be a better spot than the one that I'm on. And in recent years I've gone the other way. I've gone to, I know there's fish in the swim, like, you know, that bump down, okay, that'll do. And I think I've caught less since I've been like that. And Kev Hewitt reminded me in that last interview that he says he never goes to bed without being super happy with all of his rods, and he don't care how many casts it takes, he'll get it right until he gets that, you know, the sweet spot, the bump down that is like, yeah, I'm leaving that till I go home, that's a bite, that one. And I used to be like that. It's one of my strengths, was to really fine tune spots and to, you know, kind of just make sure I'm happy and confident at all times. And I certainly wasn't that first night. So on my second first full day, like you know, gearing up towards the second night, I had a good plumb around and got a bit happier. The rods that were straight out in front, they were I'm still not saying they're great, because we've got a difficult situation in the fact that, you know, it's slightly out of my comfort zone. I can't feel a nice drop on the lead, you know, to feel the lead bump down. It's shallowish and the bottom is quite choddy. I actually think the bottom is clearer than I think. There's a lot of clay around, so it feels soft, because it does seem to be clay. It's been raining heavy while we've been here, and, you know, our boots are sticking in the grass, so it shows that the ground's got very high clay content, which is obviously good for the lake. You know, lakes thrive with a high clay content, which is possibly why the fish have got this big. But it explains to me what I'm feeling sometimes, and the lead plugs in, but then you think it's in weed, but you pull it back and it's clean. And that's happened on quite a few of the areas that I've fished. The lead's plugging in and you think you're pulling through weed, and then, you know, there's not a scrape on anything. So I'm kind of having to chuck out blind almost, because I'm kind of having to trust that it's in the right place, and I know there's no weed there, but without feeling that bump that gives me the confidence to just leave it all night. So
would you have actually fished that area if you wouldn't have known that you'd been fished there, caught from there in the past? Is that a saving grace, or would you have moved off that area and not bothered?
Yeah, I'd have probably moved off it. I'd have probably written it off. But as I was casting around, so I'm persevering with those spots. Because there's like nobody fishing it, there's no syndicate, there's no rules, it's not day ticket or anything, it's like exclusive access. So we can use four rods. We can kind of do what we want. It's us against the fish with no restrictions. So I had a lead around with a fourth rod into an area, and I found a spot that was 6 foot. Nowhere on the lake is 6 foot. So it's definitely a hole or a depression or something. And it does seem to be bumping down okay. And I did kind of find it briefly on my first night, but didn't think I fished it properly. But the second night, I made sure it was right. And at 3 in the afternoon, so we've been here about 24 hours, just over. About 3 in the afternoon, I got a bite off that rod. Which was, you remember how big it was? That first one? It weeded me up. So I'd actually just been up to photograph a fish for you, hadn't I? I'd been up here for something. We're sat in Roger's Peg now as we speak. So we haven't mentioned the weather. The weather's been ridiculous for January. It's when we drove down on Sunday afternoon, it was it peaked in the car at 17 degrees on the temperature thing. When we came into this area, this part of the country that should remain nameless, it was 15 degrees.
And obviously that was on the Sunday, and bear in mind I had fished it the previous Tuesday and it had froze overnight. It had a -6 on the Tuesday morning. We knew it had been frozen until the Friday morning. There was still ice on the Friday, so it only thawed out from Friday, sort of like late morning, Friday afternoon.
Yeah, it's been defrosted for 2 days. But it's a 20 degree shift upwards from -6 to +15. It's an over 20 degree shift. So with it being a shallow lake, it's a really good point. I find that shallow lakes respond very quickly in winter to changes in temperature. Excuse me, hiccuping, that's the Budweiser. To changes in temperatures. So the signs were obviously good, but we had kind of extreme warm conditions. It was overcast, it was drizzly, the south-southwesterly wind kind of blows. We're allowed to fish one bank on here, but the lake, we say it's rectangular, it's 120 yards across probably, at the furthest point. So we can fish all the lake from our side that we're allowed to fish. I'm covering like the bottom third of the lake. Roger's covering the middle third of the lake, and then there's the top third of the lake. Somebody else could go in, but that does seem to be shallower. And there's quite a few swans on here as well. And I wouldn't want to be fishing in 3.5 foot. The swans are a bit of a pain in the backside anyway. They're trying to get the bait when you spot, and they seem very hungry. I mean, it's winter; they've probably not been fed for a while. They seem extra hungry. But I had a bite off at 3 in the afternoon, and that was kind of the start of it. It was a smallish fish, the first one. I think it was like it was a low 20, actually, wasn't it? Like 24 pound, I think, the first one. It weeded me up for a bit. I actually thought I was going to lose it, and we have not hooked a fish for ages. Roger was telling me off for being a bit soft with it.
But, put a bend in the rod. Put a bend in the rod.
I didn't want to lose it.
Playing it like a girl.
You know, it's like you've not caught a fish for a while. It's your first buyout on new lake. Bear in mind, so Roger's hauled the first night, and I've not caught, and so I'm now feeling like the pressure's on. I need to catch. I can't be going away. And I know John's had a few fish as well. I'm thinking, I'm the name guy here. I'm the guy that's got to come back with my head held high. I've got to try and catch something, otherwise I'll never live it down. So I didn't want to lose this fish. And it did weed up solid. I did the slack line technique and tried to... I pulled to the point where I didn't want to pull anymore and it didn't move. And then I did the slack line technique. And then usually where you like let all the weeds stand up again, it really works in thick Canadian. The fish will... Like, the weed... When you pull against the weed, you're pulling the fish into a weed, which is compressing the weed even more in Canadian. And if you slacken the line off, it lets the weed stand upright again. The fish thinks it's free and it usually swims out. and you get a screaming take again. You just have to put the rod on the rest, slacken the line off, keep slacking it off, because it will tighten up as the weed stands upright and starts pulling the line back. Keep slackening it. But this didn't really happen. The fish didn't move off again. And I gave it another pull, and then on about the third or fourth time that I attempted to pull it, when now we're discussing options of pulling for a break, or you know, there's no way of getting a boat or anything. We're looking at the options, trying to get different line angles, but there's trees in the way, so we can't get around the lake. And you know, options were just pull really hard, and if it comes off, it comes off.
So eventually you actually pulled and made the rod bend a little bit.
Yeah, I made the rod bend a bit, but it actually, when I put the rod down again, when it wasn't moving, it actually did move off of its own accord. Like, I felt the line tighten in my hand, and it kind of came out on its own, landed it, it was 24 pound. Anyway, that started a crazy 24 hours fishing. So I had one at 3, I had one at 5, one at 7. Like, every couple of hours I was getting a bite. Then I ended up catching a 30, one at 34 pounds something. Was that...
Yeah.
I remember coming and waking me... That's right, I came and woke you up. So this is all... It's now about midnight, but Roger's not catching now. Like, the tables have turned. So Roger's now thinking, oh, fish have all moved down. Like, we're now thinking maybe there's less fish in here, and we think there's one group of fish. Roger was on them the first night and they've moved down.
I mean, bear in mind, the first night I had 4 fish, so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, 4 fish, not much sleep. The next morning, the morning before Jamie started to catch, I got all my rods sorted out quite early, rebaited, put the rigs back out on the spots for, oh, you know, there's a very high chance I might get my first daytime bites off this area now, because I've just had 4 fish overnight. Just nothing, no bleeps, no nothing. Next minute, Jamie's walking down every couple of hours through the day. I've had another one, I've had another one, I've had another one. So I'm starting to think probably what fish were on me maybe the first night. They've moved off, obviously moved a bit further down the lake. Jamie started to pick fish up, and might be the end of my session. You know, it's just looked great for you from that point on, didn't it?
And everything was on the one rod. It was on the 6-foot spot that I'd found. It was a bit further out. It was like... 24 wraps out, which is actually like almost all the way over the other side of the lake. You know, if we were allowed to fish the other bank, we'd be fishing 20 yards out. But as I said to Roger, Roger likes fishing at long range, and if we were on that bank, he'd probably have been fishing 80 yards over to this side where we're sat now. But this 6-foot spot was like quite a bit further over, and all the bites were on that spot. So it's now got to about midnight, and I've still got 3 rods out in an area where the other lads have been catching from, and I've not had a bite off that now. And I've had probably 4 or something off this one rod that's different to all the others. So I've pulled in one of the rods off that area, off the area the other lads have been fishing, and banged it up the side of my long rod, and kept catching. I had a 34. Which is a cracking fish, because most of them were like low to mid 20s. I had one really small one, about 15 pound, a common. Most of the fish are mirrors in here. It was crazy. We had no sleep basically. But then you started catching, didn't you?
Yeah. After
it was
watching,
late for
after watching
swim.
You catch all day and having such a good night the first night. You know, it got to midnight. I was in bed, and eventually I started to get a couple of bleeps on the alarm, the odd 1 and 2 inch lift, which normally signals there's, you know, there's something going on out there. And not long after that, I had what was it, that common?
Yeah, you had a nice looking common.
Mid
25, was it?
Yeah, I had a 25 common, and then it was pretty consistent through the night. Then just like it had been the other nights, it really does seem like a nighttime spot. They just, for some reason, I don't even know why. In session.
We'll check back in on the session shortly, hotting up nicely. Where should we go from here? What about, let's have another story, another one that got away story. Who do you want to pick, Mark?
Ooh, another guy I quite look up to, even though he's younger than me. Daryl Peck.
Right, well, the big one, or the big ones that got away from me, the ones that definitely hurt the most. The first one would be I was fishing at Colnmere for the Black Mirror, and I'd done the autumn on there. I'd probably done maybe 10 nights and seen Jim Shelley catch it. I've gone back in the spring, and John Mack has really been banging on about the fish coming out from the rat hole. I think half of its ever captures had come from this particular swim out towards the middle of the lake. And I sat up on there in my first session of the spring in the afternoon. The wind was trickling down into there perfect. I woke up in the morning, packed all my gear up, stashed it in the bushes. And I remember I just like walked away from my rods just around this corner of this bush, and I've heard my buzzer go, gone round there and landed a 17-pounder, which on the mere was a right result. And while I was trying to tie the bait back onto a fresh rig, the other rod just screamed off, and I just remember thinking, I don't believe this, and picked into it. It took a load of line, and I was trembling, man. I don't mind admitting it. I was shaking like a leaf, thinking, oh my God, this is it, this is it. And it weeded up, and it came out of the weed, and I got it back about 20 yards, and it weeded up, and all the way it was feeling like a really good fish. And then once it came clear of the weed, I put the net down into the water. It was about 20 yards out, and just for no reason at all, the hook just sprung back, and it was just gone, you know. And when you're fishing a lake like that, with a fish like that, and you're in the peg where it comes from, and it hadn't been out, it was due, it broke my heart. And then I remember a little while later, Steve Briggs caught it, and then it was died, you know. So to have lost that, it might not have been that, but there wasn't many, many big fish in there, and to have hooked a big one from that swim in that zone at that time, it was all pointing. Everyone was saying, oh, you've lost. People were saying, I've lost it more than me. Do you know what I mean? They said, oh, I definitely lost it. It was definitely here. And I don't know. That was absolutely brutal. But another one, I was fishing at Burfield. I was fishing on the point. I think they called it not Hodder's Point, Barnett's Point. And I knew the fish were at the other end of the lake, and the wind was due to change. And it turned in the morning, was like hacking from where they were towards where I was in this like bottleneck where they had to come past me. And I was fishing between these boys. The boys were about 70 yards out, and I was sort of halfway between the boys. So I probably had like 30 yards of water either side. And I thought, if I get a take, I'm going to get on it, and I'm going to really pull to make sure I get it my side of the boys. So when it's gone off, run down to the rod, picked into it, tried to get it my side of the boys, and just got flat rodded. And one minute I'm fishing at 70 yards out, and the next minute I've got 150 yards of line out in one run, and I'm pulling much harder than I wanted to. The rod wasn't even bent. It was so bent, it was flat. The rod was like flat in my hand, pointing at the fish, and the clutch was making this horrible noise. It's going, and it just plowed into this island 150 yards out, and it was exploding under the trees, and I put it back into the rest, and it'd take line, and I'd put it back to the same snag. And in the end, we got the boat, but by the time we got the boat, it was gone, man. I've caught some big fish in my time, but nothing has ever pulled like that. I've caught sturgeon that pulled like that, but I've never caught a carp that's pulled like that.
Wow. Absolute sickness. I had one on Fen Drayton that was exactly the same. I was on braid as well. Ended up opening out a size 6, caught a wide gape. I've never felt. I probably will tell a story on this at some point, but that's the only one that ever stuck in my mind. If I can have one fish back, I'm sure yours would be the Black Mirror, and that one bite that you would take back if you could.
I'm just thinking it would definitely be that one, just because of the odds, you know. Not many big fish in there, and there's not many that would have felt like that, whereas the other one at Burfield at the time, there's a load of 40s in there, and those simos, they go like stink. So I'm not saying it was a Burfield common, but who knows? You don't want to be losing the ones that pull like that.
No. I remember when we were on Yateley, everybody said it was, what was this supposedly hardest fighting one-on while we were on there? Was it
ever?
Heather, yeah. And then I remember somebody losing one that was, I mean, you lose a mirror on Yateley, like it was a big deal. No matter which one it was one you did not want to lose. But I think the other people that caught Heather that year said that Heather hadn't gone like that. And there was another one that was fighting crazy.
I think Dustin and Single were both known to go at times as well, I think.
Yeah, I think it probably was Single actually. I don't know, I think I forget, oh, my memory's gone again. I'm going to get this wrong and get the wrong way around. But yeah, whichever one it was the other one that, because they were saying, oh, single always goes crazy. That's right. I think they were saying single always goes crazy. And that year, Heather the Leather was going like a steam train and single was getting a bit tired. Because I think it died not long after the following year, didn't it, single?
Yeah.
It just plodded when I had it. It did the sort of 30 yard run on the take and then pretty much just plodded around and, you know, typical sort of big heavy fish. But the water was cold then as well, so it was December, I think.
Just imagine if Darrell lost the Black Mirror and the Burfield Common, you know, two of the finest, without doubt the finest carp in the land. You know, it sounds pretty certain that the Black Mirror was the one he lost. Burfield, like I say, there's a few big fish in there, and you know, I've had crazy fish that you think are the biggest fish in the lake and they're not when you get them in. You must have had that.
Yeah, I've had a few fish where you see them roll for the first time in front of you and you just think, where's the rest of you, is that it? Just those, you know, bionic doubles or 20s. And I have had you know, a lot of bigger fish which just came in dog on a lead. But on the other hand, I've also had big fish which fight like big fish with steroids.
I've had this conversation with Darrell a few times actually about the really big ones. Quite often the big, you know, the big heavy wide ones, they just shake their head. They're like a dogged weight, you know, just like heavy. You quite often get the first run, but generally you're guiding them back in and it's just heavy with some head shaking, and the fat ones do tend to do that head shaking. Yeah. I think it's because they're waddling, you know, maybe they haven't got enough power in their fins to move 50 odd pound away or 45 pound plus away, but so they, you know, they get used to shaking the head a lot more. But I've had quite a few that do that, but there are a few big ones. That Jim's Common that I had from the Cheshire Park Lake, that went like stink. You know, I knew it was a big fish. The mother went like stink, you know, on the bite.
Yeah, rub it in with the mother.
Oh, sorry. you know, there's a few, but you can tell by the shape of them usually. Darrell kind of mentioned my one that got away, or I mentioned it in Darrell's bit there. And so I might as well tell the story. It's when I fished Fen Drayton. We were boat fishing, and there was a fish in there known as the stripy common, which had never been caught. It was a huge common. I actually believe it was one of the Woolpack original commons. So we know that paddle went 50 pound in the Woolpack. So those commons were introduced. Do you remember the year when they put them commons in the Woolpack? Was it like 79 or something?
I don't know, but it was probably around then. It was a long, long time ago.
Yeah, and then but there was a stocking of commons. I forget how many of them, but basically it was a flood not long afterwards, and the lakes down there, they're all in a line, aren't they, alongside the A14. A bit further down from the Woolpack, you've got Fen Drayton, Ferry Lagoon, the St. Ives complex. So they're all kind of in a line.
Yeah. Fish did get spread out quite a bit.
Yeah, but without doubt, I mean, there was miles and miles underwater because the river runs down the back of them, and the fish almost certainly lost most of them commons, I think. I think it actually put the owners of the Woolpack at the time out of business because they'd spent tons and tons of money on this stocking and then lost them, or most of them, obviously, you know, no, probably found it harder to sell tickets. I don't really know. As we know, the ones that got left in the Woolpack went big. There's a number of 40 pound plus commons in there, including paddle, which is the biggest, 50, and a lot of them were quite long lean fish, you know, not fat fish at all, were they? They're all like nice shaped carp. Anyway, a 50 pound common turned up in Ferry Lagoon a number of years later. Not sure if it's still there.
I'm not sure anything down there anymore, but it's same with literally just over the other side of the river from Fen is you know, the Scout Lake.
That's right.
Big common in there, and the big mirror in there, It's called the Woolpack Fish.
There you go. You know, the Woolpack stocked half those lakes down there. And obviously it took a lot of years afterwards for them to get big. But they were very similar type shapes. And it was this really well-proportioned long common. You know, if you're picturing it, it's not dissimilar to the Burfield Common shape. You know, quite a long, just perfectly proportioned in all diameters. And then obviously Ferry Lagoon had one. That, you know, went a good 50, and Fendrayton had one. Now some people believe the Fendrayton, the Ferry Lagoon one, was the same fish. So I spoke to a chap who fishes down there, a real sort of very good angler, good watcher. He knows what's in all them lakes in that area. Very secretive guy, but you know, got chatting to him over a period of time on what was the one we got permission to fish across the road,
Farfen.
Yeah, on Farfen. Anyway, he told me he almost lost his business and his wife over chasing the stripy common, as it was called, out of Fen. Anyway, on one of the subsequent floods after that, he said he watched it swim into Ferry Lagoon. So he'd watched it with his own eyes when all the road was flooded. He was sat up on a gate and, you know, the fish were swimming down the road. And he said he saw 50-pound common. He believed it to be the stripy common, the one that he'd been watching for years in Fen, trying to catch, almost ruining his life over. And he said he saw it with his own eyes swimming to Ferry Lagoon, and that's the 50-odd common that's been caught out of Ferry Lagoon. Now, what he doesn't know, or didn't know till I told him then, is that there was a big common, the stripy common, was still in Fen, because I saw it with my own eyes, so did Dave, so did Shelley, a number of people. 100% the stripy common was still in, so he saw a different one. Which went on to be the, you know, I think it went to near mid 50, didn't it? The one in Ferry, if the rumours are to be believed.
Yeah, it's all rumoured. You know, I've never seen a picture of that.
I've never seen a picture of that one, but that guy, AD, was called, he's definitely not a bullshitter. He knows all the fish in that area. And, you know, he said, I watched it with my own eyes, and that was the end of his campaign. So it was a good thing because he kind of got his life back. But anyway, I said, well, that wasn't that one, because 100%. So then many years on, I'm fishing Fendrayton. I'm out in the boat. In fact, our friend Roger Bacon was on a guest session, and he'd come to Fen with us, and I'm showing him the boat, and you know, it's the first lake I'd ever fish where he could use a boat and look at spots and stuff. So we're out in the lake looking for fish, looking at spots, just general mooching, and Dave, our friend, is up a tree on the far bank, which is the riverbank, the jungle as they used to call it. He's up a tree on there. Next thing, he rings me and he's shaking in his voice. He's like, get here now, get the boat over here, get here. He's proper like, I thought he'd broke his leg or something. I thought he'd fell out of a tree. Like, he sounded panicked. And anyway, he was looking at the stripy common from up the tree. It was in the back of a little bay or a little recess. You know, you get them recess bits on big lakes and all this kind of debris gathers on the surface, all the little white bits off the trees. Yeah. And fish love sitting in that stuff. You ever see that? There's always fish underneath it, 'cause it's like a cover for them, like a canopy. And he was in there, and there was a hole in the weed, and he'd seen this fish. He said, it's 60 pound plus. That was his exact words. It's 60 pound plus. There's a group of fish here, and there's a fish like I've never seen in my life. So me and Roger shot straight over there with the boat. We drifted into the edge of this bay, and there was a group of fish. There was another one there that Shelley reckoned had gone, actually. It was a Scraper 40 mirror. He hadn't seen it for years in that lake. He thought he'd gone, died, or got out in a flood. And 100% we ID'd it. When I told Jim it, he knew what fish it was straight away. He went, no one's seen that in years. Like years and years. And anyway, we saw this common. From the boat, it was clearly a big fish. It was clearly bigger than this 40 mirror. But I wasn't thinking, no, it's the 65 pound plus that Dave's saying it is. You know, I saw it was a very big fish, but not quite that big. But there was a group of fish there, four or five fish, which was unusual to find a group of fish on Fen, you know, especially seeing them clearly. But one of them was this horrendously large common. But Dave's shaking, like he's seen something that's absolutely blown him away. And obviously, we're in a boat at almost like water level. So you don't get the full depth and proportion of a fish, do you, from when you're kind of at level with it. And he's up a tree, you know, 15, 20 foot up in the air. Anyway, so after that Roger, I went home a day before them two, and Roger saw it. We basically set up either side of this bay. We didn't set up in the bay so as not to scare them. There was two bars running off that margin, so we decided to make a plan for the next few sessions and fish either side of this bay, one each side. So they set up there. I went home, and Roger saw it. He was going to take the boat to the boat park on the last day, and as soon as he went round that corner towards where the bay is, that fish was there, and he nearly fell out the boat. Said it was huge, absolutely huge. Anyway, the following week, Dave and I are fishing either side. We started to get like a bite per session, which was good for fen draining in them days. It was very good. I think I had a common. I then lost one of the really pretty scaly mirrors, about scraper 30, but I lost it in weed, hand lining it up out the weed and into the net. I mean, I touched the fish. I could have, if I'd have had the net in my hand, I could have scooped it. So it kind of felt like I caught it because I saw what it was.
You tagged it.
Yeah, it's just I didn't have the net in my hand when I didn't realise how easy it was coming up out of the weed when I was over the top of it. And instead of, I know now to get the net ready because they just come up and you can scoop them dead easy. This is the first time I'd ever done that. So I was pulling it up and it just kept coming so easy. I thought I'd keep pulling, have a look what it is. And when I got it to the surface, saw it was one of them really pretty scraper 30 mirrors. I then thought, I better net it now. Now I've seen it. And it just shook its head and the hook fell out. But in hindsight, I'd have caught that. Anyway, so I'd had those two fish. This is over the next two or three sessions. And me and David took it in turns to go in that peg as well, because that seemed to be doing more bites than the other side. I think Dave had a bite out of there. So it's now done like three bites. Bear in mind, we'd seen five fish from that bank. We'd had three bites, I think. And the following session, we've got back. It was my turn to go in that peg. Put the rods along the bar on the first where we'd got the other bites from. The next morning, I've awoke. All the bites were at 7 a.m. as well in the morning. So I'll say we're doing a three-night session. We'd get like maybe one or two. This had gone on for like 3 weeks. I just felt that big common was going to slip up at some point because we weren't fishing where it was, but we were fishing where it had to come out of this bay. Along these bars, there was a bar either edge of the bay that ran out towards the middle of the lake. It was always going to come out along one of them bars, so you know we were ambushing the bars without ever fishing in the bay. And this third session where we'd had a bite each week, I had a screaming take. We're fishing braid because we're fishing up to like 300 yards out, so we're fishing like the Nash bullet braid, and my clutches were a little bit tight, I think. Anyway, I had an absolute melter, like just whizz. I've come flying out of the bivvy at 7 a.m. and I can see the rod tip banging as the line's flying out, and I picked the rod up, the rod hooped over, and I like held on like a water skier. I just held on, this thing just went, it just shot 30 yards, 40 yards maybe, and then come off. I was like, what? I was like, it must have snapped. Hook link must have snapped or something. I mean, it was flat rodding me. You know, I'm just like holding on to the rod. And anyway, the hook had opened. It was a size 6 quarter wide gape. Never used another one after that day. And the hook was almost straight. I was sick as a dog. One, not blaming the hook, but for fishing braid that's got no forgivingness, like there's no stretching it at all. My clutch was too tight. 100% that hook was probably bent from the second it was running, just because of the pressure it was taking to drag braid that's got no kind of resistance. And I obviously couldn't get the, because the clutch was too tight, I couldn't get the rod up high enough, you know, so it's almost flat rodded, so you've not got the bend of the rod like cushioning the fish running, You know, I'm kind of almost pointing the rod at the fish with no stretch, no rod to bend. No, so it's basically just pulling direct on the thing. And I think it was just those factors combined that opened it. And I'll never, ever know what fish that was, but I've never felt a fish like it, ever. It was unreal. And was it that stripey common? We'll never know.
No, I can just imagine you and Dave, every bleep, every take you've had while leading up to that, you've got to have been shaking like a leaf thinking it could be that common any time.
Exactly. Exactly. The cat's banging the window to get out, so I'm going to pause. Yes, obviously sick as a dog. I mean, if there's one fish, it doesn't matter what fish it was, like in Fenn, they were all pretty decent at the time. A lot of fish went in there in subsequent years after that, but in them days it was the same 20 fish that got caught, if that, maybe less. You know, and they're all pretty decent. And there was, you know, rumours of all the missing ones, the you know, the big one that Shelley had, the 48, was it, the leather. There was a few. It could have been anything, but I don't know. To this day, I always think that was the one chance for a fish that never ever got caught. And that's the thing I didn't tell you. From when Dave first saw it in the boat to the story I've just told you about losing it, we were fishing that bank and I was fishing that bay. Anyway, I got up that same tree. Obviously, that tree that Dave saw him from, we used to go up that like 20 times a day. You know, every half hour you'd go and check the tree again, see if the fish were in that bay. So, and we were trying to get a picture of it as well, so we'd always take the camera. Yeah. And we'd done this on one of the sessions before I lost that fish. And I'm up the tree with a camera, didn't see anything, which wasn't unusual. You know, we've been up there dozens and dozens of times now. And to get the camera down, I would hang it on a branch just below me, you know, like just out of arm's reach kind of thing, hang it so that when I climbed down, I could just like lift it off the branch and then go back to my peg. And then so I put the camera down and I've just glanced over this like hole of weed in the bay, and that fish, the stripey common, came across it. Now, this is a hole, I'm looking at my kitchen table now, maybe 5 foot by 5 foot and round, maybe 6 by 6, this hole in the weed. Yeah. And I'm directly above it in this tree, and this fish came from one side of the hole in towards the bank, facing towards the bank, and swam across the full open bit. So I saw a full 6 foot, I saw it swim across the full 6 foot of the open bit. And I saw it from the angle that Dave saw it at when me and Roger were in the boat. I've never seen to this day a fish that even comes close. Like, I remember telling people at the time, if I had to put a weight on it, and bear in mind I was fishing Yateley at the time, Yateley Car Park Lake, that had two known 50s in it. And as I've explained before, on Yateley you would see the fish almost every day. You could go round the big high trees and you could find them. So I was used to looking at heather, which was a scraper 50. I was used to seeing that from a tree from right above it. You know, I'd seen it dozens of times. So I've got a direct comparison to compare this fish to a 50 pound carp. And if I had to guess, I mean, my guess would sound stupidly bigger than heather, so I won't put a weight on it, but it's so much bigger than heather. It was untrue. I was driving a Peugeot 405 at the time, a white one, and the old 405s, the steering wheels on them were huge. The steering wheels probably 2.5 foot wide from one side to one side. And I remember looking at my hands, because obviously my hands are on that steering wheel a lot, driving to and from the lake. I remember looking at my hands and thinking, that fish is wider than my steering wheel, like the width across at the top of its back. Now, I caught a 51.5 from Nash's the other week, which was an extremely wide, chunky fish. And this fish was half as wide again. Easy. But it was long. It was it wasn't fat. It was like paddle. It was, you know, that type of shape, but the widest fish I've ever seen. A good 3.5 foot long, 4 foot long maybe, who knows. It was just huge, and to this day I've never seen a carp that big. and maybe I lost it, maybe I lost that long 40 mirror, maybe I lost a really hard fight in 25, but it was like nothing I've ever felt before, and I've caught a lot of fish in my time. If I could have it back, I'd take it back right now.
Then would you slacken your clutch off or have a different hook on?
Both. Yeah, I've never, I mean, you live and learn, don't you? We're always learning in fishing. Oh, yeah. You know, you learn by mistakes a lot of the time as well. And you know, I think there was a combination of factors there that lost me that fish. Was it that big 50, 60, 65 pound common? Who knows? Ben managed over 10 years ago, and I think the way I was telling people at the time was 55 to 65. Wouldn't surprise me if it was 55, it wouldn't surprise me if it was 65.
Yeah, they can be deceiving, especially with commons. You know,
Across its back. It was unreal. Like, it was a good 2 to 2.5 foot wide across its back.
Here's a question: did you have any more sightings of it in that bay after your loss?
No, never saw it again. I've not spoke to anyone that's seen it again. I mean, there was another flood a few years. There's been a couple from then till now. There's been a couple of major floods. As you know, Fen actually lost most of its fish not too long ago. It gained a few from Ferry Lagoon next door, including a 50 mirror that is fairly infamous. What was that one called?
It was the Ferry Lagoon linear or half linear.
Yeah, and then... it died.
Let's not get political in that story.
Rumouredly found in a ditch at the side of Fen and then put in Fen. Apparently Jim Shelley caught it minutes after it was put in, and then it died. Yeah, make of that what you will.
It was a big can of worms, but we'll leave that one alone, I think.
Let's talk in sessions. Let's check back in my mind.
In session.
How are you catching? How are you adapting to the shallow water?
Well, the way I fish the shallow water is I've spoke to some lads that I've fished here before and they've used chods. Now, to be honest, I'm not really a great chod man, and not unless it's really staring you in the face. That is the only way to go, will I actually use a chod. I'm quite a long walk length man, so I've had a cast around. I found a couple of areas where I can hit the bottom. I'm feeling a bump. I'm not getting a pullback at all. You know, if you pull back, you're just straight in weed, but I can feel it hitting the bottom. And 8 out of 10 casts anywhere else, I'm not even getting that. So all I've done is I've put 10 kilo boilies on this session.
Yeah.
I've used 10 kilo boilies in the area that's split between the three rods, which are probably 25, 30 yards apart. But the different thing about the 10 kilo put in is probably 8 of that key has been crumb. I've crumbed all my bait up. I've used a little bit of a little bit of corn, a little bit of... basically just used a load of bit. So kind of wanting to scent the area up, really, so if fish do move in, you know, they can sense this stuff there, but they've not got that 10 key of straight boilie that's just scattered about all over where they might, you know, pick a quarter key up and move on.
You've not put 10 key in one go though, have you?
No, I've not put 10 key in one go. No, it's just while I've been here, I've gone through the 10 key. On top of that, I've just been using the Cordo funnel webs, quite big bags, but just threading my hook length through it, snowman rigs on the end, quite long hook length, so I'm just casting that out, getting a bump, and
just a big bag to stop it, to protect the hook wherever it lands.
Yeah, just to protect the hook, really, so wherever it lands, even if you are in weed or you're not quite perfect, you know, you've got a nice little clump of dust or crumb around your upbait, and it's worth a treat.
So basically you copied my method that I've fished for the last 12 years.
but my bags are about 10 times the size of yours are tiny.
Yeah, the bags that you're using, which is the thicker Corda funnel web, I normally use the boilie one, and mainly because I like to drop my lead when I, you know, use like the Nash weed clips, and I like to drop the lead on most fish, and if you cast a bigger bag out with a normal lead clip, it generally pulls the lead off when it hits the water. You have to really like hit the clip at the perfect angle so you don't pull it off. So I would prefer to use bags as big as you're using them, but I lose too many leads doing that. You know,
I mean, obviously the other option you've got is having the actual everything inside the bag,
a solid bag.
But I don't really like fishing solid bags, so I just fish it the way I do. But you've just got to make sure every cast is, you know, rod length over, basically, so as it lands it's all in a tight line and it stops the lead from being stripped off.
Yeah, so you're fishing long hook links, snowman rig, mm-hmm. And quite a big stocking type bag, just so Do you think the weight of a heavy bag, like if it does happen to land in weed, it's still just going to, it's going to squash it, isn't it? It's still going to be fishing.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've had a good cast around of that area, and I know the general area that I'm fishing to, it's not solid weed. So I'm quite happy. I mean, even if I land, you know, 3 foot to the left or right of the actual mark that I'm aiming for, and it doesn't land on that mark, because I've got that big bag on it, if I feel any sort of drop, I'll think, well, that'll do, I'll just leave it there, and, you know, it's effective, it's fishing.
So you started catching, like, even though, you know, the tables had turned and I'd started hauling, I'd had a fair few bites between 3 in the afternoon and midnight. Your spot kicked again, didn't it? At what time? Midnight-ish or something?
Started at midnight. I went right through till 6 in the morning, really. I mean, both our spots were fishing that.
We both caught all night, didn't we? Yeah, it was our bivvies are about 100 yards apart, something like that. Roger's getting a Facebook call. Our bivvies about 100 yards apart, so, you know, we've got our receivers and we're in one peg or the other, and with this clay, like clayey, grassy, wet stuff, my legs are aching from walking back and forth between the two bivvies. Either he was coming down to take a picture for me, I was going up to wake him up to come and take a picture. We've been back and forwards literally all night with no sleep. And you had what, maybe four fish between midnight and
it was a better night, actually. The first night was all, you know, there was four fish, they were only 18 to 20 pound. I started off with that mid 20 common. Then he had a smaller one, then he had a 27 mirror, nice clean looking scaleless mirror, and ended up with that linear, wasn't it? It was a 28 linear, that was my last fish. So yeah, it was a good night's fishing.
Yeah, well, that one, so we both ended up having a fish just before first light, and again the previous bites had been in darkness, so to catch a fish like just as it had got light, and like I'd been up all night, I think I got the last stint between like my 3 a.m. fish, and then I think I got like a 2 hour period from 3 till like 5:30 before I got a bite, which was the longest period I went from 3 in the afternoon without having a bite. And then at first light, that's right, I came up to tell Roger that I'd had another one that I needed a picture of. I think that was a 30. I'm not sure, it was a better one anyway. It might have been a mid-20, that one. And a slightly better one than some of the small ones I've been catching. I said, I'm going to need a picture in the morning. I'll put it in the retainer sling. And he said, as I came up, you went, I've got a nice linear in the retainer sling as well, which was the 28, as just mentioned. So, right, okay, well, it's getting light in an hour. And I don't like retaining fish, really. We'd been taking all the pictures we'd took in the dark, but we've both actually got a fish worth photographing, and like it's getting light in an hour, so we both said we'd retain them. So I traipsed back to my peg, like very tired, and the second I walked into my peg, another rod's ripping. It's at the point now we're getting so many bites, it's like, oh, another one. Don't get me wrong, if there's a 30, 40, 50 pounder, any fish in the end, I'm going to be happy, but the action had been quite intense, and when you're sleep deprived, you're not thinking straight. And anyway, this fish kited to the left. Oh, the bite is off. It's off the spot that's straight out that the lads had previously caught, and it's the first bite I'd had that's not on the 6 foot spot that I'd found. So I was actually quite pleased to get another area going. The fish kited left, and then there's a rope that goes across the lake at one point, and somebody's obviously lost line at some point on it, and the fish has got snagged on somebody else's line underneath this rope, because the rope doesn't go to the bottom. I thought that it I could just put the rod tip under the water and it would be fine, I'd just pull the fish back under it, but it's got snagged on somebody else's line, so I've ended up losing that one. But I think I'd had 8 bites at that point, from 3 in the afternoon until 6 o'clock in the morning. Maybe 8 bites, which is, that's crazy. I mean, that's going down as one of my most epic sessions ever. And that took us up till, 8 o'clock this morning. We did the pictures. The conditions are still just super mild, you know, definitely mid-doubles, it's drizzly. It's the ultimate carp conditions. I mean, we had a session on Elstow 1, didn't we, about 10 years ago. in January that had similar conditions, you know, strong gale force winds, and you had a pretty decent hit, didn't you, in one corner of the lake where the wind was blowing. But I can't think of many times in January where I've had that, where I've had that action.
In session.
Let's have another one that got away story from one of our celeb anglers. Who do you want next, Mark?
Who have we not had now? What have we got? John Mack?
John Mack, yeah, let's get him on.
Well, the one that got away, I suppose, there is one that haunts me to this day, but there are two or, you know, a couple of others. I mean, firstly, let's get it right, I really wanted Mary. Mary died the year that I was on there. So, yeah, it kind of got away. It got away from me. I saw it on the bank in December, and it died the following August, I think it was. That one kind of got away, but I've had a little dabble on Burfield, that common, that's eluded me so far, but rules have changed and stuff, didn't quite end up being the lake that it was when I first sort of fished there, so that one has kind of been put to the side, but who knows, we'll come back to that one day. But I think the one that really got away has got to be a fish that I know that you call. It's the Fat Lady from St. Ives Lagoon. That lake, I fished that lake, I think, for about 3 years trying to catch that fish. I've seen that fish on the bank. I can't tell you how many times I photographed that fish. I knew when it would come out. We always knew when it would come out. It was out on a new moon. Drizzly, grey, but not too wet. And you could look in the sky and it was grey. And you go, she's coming out today. And I was right. 9.5 times out of 10. You knew when she'd be out. I couldn't work out where she'd come out. Anyway, so one particular year, I mean, I've done all right on there. I think, you know, I was chopping and changing with bait, because bait played a pretty key factor on that lake, believe it or not. And there was a bait that I was trying. And in the end, I should have been using one of the same company's other baits, and I won't say what it was. But, I had to fight. In fact, what happened, I'll tell you what happened, I was actually off my rods. Not far off my rods, but I was on one of the points, and I was standing on the fence, literally just out of the swim. I thought, oh, I'll hear my buzzer. Looking across the lake from the fence, from the viewpoint, and I saw two ducks swim around the island, come straight between the two islands, mallards they were. Remember, it was clear as anything. And then you know what they're like when they're coming along, and they're sort of like quacking about each other and all the rest of it, looking a bit frisky. And they come right over my spot. I thought, they're right over me. And they both looked down, and they flapped their wings, and they turned around and went back the way they came. And I went, that was odd. I went down to my rod, like literally round the corner to my rod, and I could see my mark on my line where I clip up to had moved further forwards by literally 6 foot, and the bobbin was fairly tight, you know. I thought, oh, I've had a bite there. Sort of like wound down, lifted the rod, and it was locked solid. And there was only two fish in there that ever didn't give you a run. One was the lady, one was the black pig or whatever they used to call it. And I'd been on there a while, and I sort of started coaxing the fish towards me, and there was a huge eruption on the surface just prior to me getting coming towards me type of thing. My mate George was on the opposite bank, and he wound his rods in. I could see him frantically winding, ran round, and he just got in my swim, and I'm there, and the fish is coming in. It's just not fighting. You just know what fish it is, and it's one of the two. And then he's passed me the net. The fish is literally in front of me, down below the surface. I didn't see the fish, but it was in front of me. It was just there, and it popped out. And then I was like, sat down, I put my hands around my face, and I didn't know what to say. You know, when you put your head in your hands type of thing, and like, Jules just went, I better go. I went, no, mate, please don't leave me. I need someone to talk to. I can't be left alone. I was shell-shocked anyway, right? Eventually, about 5 minutes later, big fish nutted out about the same range out that I lost this fish. It's probably 10 yards. 10 yards, right? A big fish nutted out just to the right of the swim, in a spot where they don't nut out. And I went to him, "That's bloody it. That's the one that I've lost." He went, "Yeah, probably is." And then I was looking out to the water, across the water, like, you know. And then I just saw the head, the shoulders, the body come right out and back down as it swam away. He did it again, didn't he? And it was the lady stuck its head out and his shoulders. And I just like, she's just come in, sulked down there, swam there, jumped out. And now she's swimming off, and it's like she just was sticking her fingers up at me, and that was a hard loss, mate. And I never caught it, and the following year I couldn't rejoin it, couldn't call it, and I thought, oh, I'll probably rejoin the following year. That year it died, but you know what? A few of my mates caught it. I'm pleased about that. And in particular, one of our best mates that you and I both know, Eddie Johnson. I was privileged and honoured to be there, and pretty much I talked him into staying when he wanted to go home, and he caught it in October or November again. And do you know what? Sometimes you can't always have the rubber to green, and every dog always has their day, you know. So,
We can't feel too sorry for you, because the list of big carp you have caught is, most people would chop their arm off for your list, but I feel your pain to know it was that fish, and that was, you know, one of the biggest fish in the country at the time. And I remember a similar story with our other mate Dave. It had just been out, he was on the session, it had just been out, and he wanted to go home. He was all deflated, and he was like, "Oh, so I've had enough, I'm going." I'm like, you know, it comes out just after it gets caught. Like, it gets caught quite often on a new moon, it comes out 2-3 days later. I talked him into staying, and he caught it about 3 hours later.
That's right,
exactly
the
same thing.
Yeah. Same thing with Eddie. I said to him, "It's been out, mate," but I said, "It hasn't been out twice in 2 days yet this year." I said, "It's going to be out this time. This is the time." He went, "Do you think so?" I was like, "Mate, I'm telling you." Anyway, next day he had a liner and a pickup, and it spat him out. And I said, "Mate, change that rig, do that, boom." Next day he had it.
What a fish that was. What a fish.
What a fish that was, the fat lady. What a beautiful fish.
The one that got away. It's unbelievable. It's a big carp, a big common carp in Austria. It has been hooked 3 times on my rods. At one time on my friend's rod. And I lost it once, and he caught it 3 times. Twice on my rods and once on his rod. So... Jesus Christ, you know, sometimes this is certainly one who did not want to be on my list.
Did not want his picture taken with you.
No, absolutely not. That was not beautiful enough. Anyway, John is not that beautiful also, but he doesn't hear it. I can say that. Anyway, if I tell him, he will say, you're right.
So how did you lose it?
Well, it was... it was like that. It was a big common who lives in a lake that was managed by Kurt Grabmaier. Do you know who Kurt Grabmaier is?
I don't think so.
Well, Kurt Grabmaier was, in fact, let's say the godfather from the Austrian carp scene.
Okay.
Very nice guy, somebody who fished a lot in the Eastern European countries, a very good friend of mine. Sadly, he died much too young. He died at the age of 52 only. And Kurt has a tackle shop also in Vienna. And you know how you know I know Kurt for quite a while, and one day I got an invitation to fish his lake. His lake was situated, let's say, maybe 20, 30 kilometers away from center Vienna, in one of the nicest oak forests that you can imagine. That was a property, or still is a property, of one of other Austrian prince. And that lake was property of that prince, and I could rent it with a couple of friends. And one day, I think must be 7-8 years ago, John Kyers and myself, we got an invitation to fish at Kurt's lake. And the deal was that John and I would do a product demo in Kurt's shop, and in return we could fish 4, 5, 6 days, how long that we wanted. So Kurt took us to the lake, and so we had to pass by a couple of fences. I have to say it's superb. Very, very beautiful. A lot of animals. Nevertheless, at the first moment, we did not see wild boars, for example, but you'd say, I can't understand it. There are hundreds of boars here, wild boars here, and I can't see one. I say, you know, he must have drunk one too much. You know, normally you see left or right, you see one if you have to drive, let's say, 2 or 3 kilometers through a forest. Anyway, so we were fishing, or we arrived in the swim, and Kurt said, I think, you know, if I were you, I would start here. You know, this is a good spot. This is a good spot. I would do it like that. So we took Kurt's advice to heart, and we fished the way he explained us. And we did it, let's say, for about 2 days. And every day we caught one or two fish, but I was not really happy. I said there must be we can have more takes or whatever if we do it differently. I say I don't know what, but anyway, I felt there was something wrong. So I stepped in the boat, went on the lake, I had a look at it. I found a carp in two areas. So that means that we had to move. From the swim where we were originally in to another swim. So I had found the areas where the carp were, but then there was a problem really to find the spots to fish, because on the left corner, for example, on the left hand, rather left hand side, about 30 meters, 40 meters out, it was all mud, but very soft mud. You know, you took a prodding stick, for example, and you easily could put it half a meter deep into the bottom. So, and that was the main holding area. So I had to try to find something, and finally, after scanning the bottom, you know, centimeter by centimeter, at a certain moment I found a little very hard spot. I don't know what it was, maybe a big rock or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, put a rod in it, placed my other rods. John fished two areas that we had been fishing the days before, so we were covering, let's say, the main part of the lake, and we fished it in a kind of rotation system. So that means if the first run is on my rod, for example, I played, the second run is straight away for the other guy. So we were fishing together, fishing together with the same bait, with the same rigs, with the same strategies, and so on. We said we do it like that. So within, I think, 1.5 hours, that little hard spot in, you know, in that area that was covered with mud, both I got it, a run on that, I don't know, it was something like 35 pounds, more or less, can be 33, can be 38, whatever, but something like that, mid 30. And from then on, it's in fact history. I caught from that spot, I don't know, fish up to, if I'm not wrong, 55 pounds or something like that. So anyway, so that was the left-hand spot. So now about the big common. That was my middle rod. So it was on John to play a carp, so I got a take on my middle rod. John played it, buff, the big comer. It was normally a carp. Yeah, it always happens to me. Yeah. But anyway, it was always a carp that was over 60 pounds. So very often it was even over 66, or between 64 and 67. And I think when John called, it was something like 63 or something, 62, 63 pounds. Don't know exactly anymore. So John called it from my middle rod. So we put it back. We continued to catch fish. And then he got a take, a couple of days later, he got a take on his rods. So in the areas where we had been fishing from the beginning. And it was that big common again. Yeah. So he caught it twice. I don't know, 3 days with 3 days difference, I think.
Yeah.
So, and this is something what I've already said when with carp that have favorite swims.
Yeah.
If a big fish had got caught in his favorite swim, it happens very often that it got caught in his second favorite swim.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then it got a little bit lost, but that's another story. So, anyway, so... John called it twice. So we went home after 4 or 5 days, whatever. So, and we went back, I think, 4 or 5 months later. I think it was October. Same story, you know, we knew more or less with the carp, what they were doing, how they were behaving, and so on. So I took my left-hand swim again. John was fishing on the right-hand side from that swim. So I was fishing again in the direction of that little hard plateau. And from the beginning, one after the other, you know, it's carp 20 kilos, 24 kilos, 22, 25 kilos, whatever. Until a certain moment, my middle rod, exactly the same swim. Now, I'm lying. There were 2 days I did not get a take on my middle rod. And I had to replace it. And it was only, I replaced it for, let's say, 2 or 3 meters. And I got a take within an hour, or within 2 hours' time. And... So I wanted to play it, so I went out in boat, but my line got stuck, so the bottom was going up and down, a lot of gravel and so on. So my line cut, I had a line cut. You know, it happens. Some you win, some you lose. Anyway, you never are happy about that, but things like that happens. So it was up to John again to play carp and so on, so we were continuing. I think 2 days later, he caught it again on his rods. Now on my rod. And it was that common carp. And it still had my hook link in his mouth.
Oh.
So I'm 100. So therefore, I'm you know, normally I don't say, you know, it was a monster that I lost. But from this one, I know it 100% sure that I had lost it 2 days before. It was on my right hand rod, on an, yeah, let's say, how do you say that, a passage in English? It's where fish go from one side to another side, a kind of, yeah, passage,
corridor. Kite, we say.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it kites from the other side. Kite,
yeah. So, and, yeah, so we hooked it 4 times. We caught it 3 times. It's not we. John, the... idiot called it 3 times and I did and I didn't catch it, but that's the way it goes, you know. If you fish together, if you do it like that, if you say, look, normally I'm an angler who likes to fish, you know, on my own. I like to do my own thing and so on, but on this was more a kind of social fishing. And if I do a social fishing like that, I like to have somebody who thinks the same way I'm thinking about fishing.
Yeah.
You know, John has caught many big fish also in his life. So he can have it that I catch a big fish, and I can have it from him that he catch a big fish. And then you work out a system to work a lake or an area with the number of rods that you are at your disposal. And then you say, okay, we fish one for you, one for me, one for you, one for you, for me. That way we have both a good time. And there is always just only one fish difference between the two guys. It has happened when I fished with somebody at one of the big lakes, also kind of social fishing session. He first said, no, I only want to catch fish on my rods. I say, okay, but, it can happen that if the fish come from left, and I was fishing on the left-hand side, said if the fish come from the left, I will stop them for you, and that can be a different. Yeah. And at the end, he said, okay, we will do it in a rotation system, so one for you, one for me. And luckily for him, at the end of the session, it was 6-6, and otherwise it was 11-1. For me, so that's the way it is. So that big common, well, he will never be on my list. I've seen it 3 times on the bank, but never in my arms.
That's a good story. I like that one. Yeah. I like that. Ronnie loves the story. I really enjoy listening to his stuff. He goes into such detail, and I love his thinking, how he thinks about carp. And it's a lot how I've thought over the years, where he just studies their habits so much. And, things you observe, like we observed the twin on Elstow too. We always talk about it, but that twin used to come out from the car park corner or the Terminator next door. And when we watched it in the edges, like, it would always be in those areas, wouldn't it? And every time it got caught, it would go off to the back bay to skulk. In fact, he got caught in February, didn't he? And got locked in the back bay because they actually filled in the bund between the back bay and the extra little bit of water at the back, and he got trapped in the other bit. But he used to go and sulk for a week, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I remember that when it got trapped because, there was all rumours going around that there was a big fish in there while everyone's still fishing the main lake, and it was your good friend Jay who caught it out of there at just shy of 44, and I remember one or two people knocking his capture, but at the end of the day, fair play, we could have all fished it, and Jay's the one that did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad I caught it out of the main lake, if I had a choice. But the funny thing was, the people reckoned they'd had it feeding in the edge in the main lake.
Yeah, we had one or two of those. It wasn't even in there.
Oh, no, I was in the twin today. I was feeding it. I had it going down the shelf. Like, no, you didn't. It wasn't even in there. Well, a few people looked a bit silly after that got caught out of the back lake. And one of them never came back, did they? If you remember. But, I just love how Ronnie, he observes everything. He's a why do things happen type guy. I think we got a couple left of the one that got away. Hope this is not too depressing for you, because we've all got these heartfelt stories.
It's something that everyone who's ever picked up a fishing rod can relate to.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think we'll finish off with Frank Warwick, but we'll fire in with Alan Blair first. Take it away.
The one that got away, we've all got those fishy tales, it was this big, but this one meant a lot to me, probably more than any other, because I actually saw the fish. I was over at La Gomera. This was this mystical island up in the mountains on an island just off Tenerife, and we'd been there a couple of days, and I'd spent most of those 2 days just trying to locate fish, get on top of them, get the rods out. This one particular incident, I was going around the lake in the Zodiac. I had a rod with me for the very reason that I might stumble across some fish and might want to fish for them. And I've been going around the lake for a couple of hours now, and I'd sort of headed into this sort of quieter corner, and I was standing up on the boat and I found a group of fish. I backed off the fish, put the boat on the bank, and then proceeded to climb along this rocky edge to where the fish were. And mate, the sight I saw, Jay, absolute chunks, real big fish. For sure, some of them were well over 50 pounds, possibly into 60 and maybe even bigger. So shaking, I tied a hook on and I had some bread and I picked the biggest one. I literally waited, I picked my moment. They were totally unaware I was there. They certainly weren't used to an angler or even anyone from the general public being in that part of the lake or looking at them. So they weren't scared, they weren't spooked. And I made a few casts, deliberately trying to get this piece of slow sinking bread to fall in front of the one I wanted, which was a colossal mirror. And eventually, after a few casts, it did, and I nailed it. I hooked it, and it dived and dived and dived and dived and dived down and cut me off. Not a huge amount more to tell of the story other than my sheer despair. I was gutted, you know, because it was without doubt the biggest fish I'd ever hooked, and I went on to lose it.
But
it's what makes us all go out another time, mate, you know. If they were all easy, then we wouldn't love it for what it is, and that story will always stay with me. I'll always remember that huge mirror engulfing that bit of slow sinking bread, me setting the hook and it just diving in the clutch, just stripping line before eventually I got cut off.
They've never been caught, those fish, have they?
No.
I know people have seen big fish in that lake, and no one's ever caught one.
Yeah, massive fish, but there's always another day.
All right, this is a story of the fish that's got away, that left a... well, I've got a couple, but there's one that sticks in my mind was on the Orient in France. I'd always wanted to fish on the Orient, you know, it's got a lot of mystique about it. A lot of big fish in there, obviously. Not a lot of big fish, but some big fish. The bulldozer, the big common that Leon Hugendyke caught that time, you know, it was a 70. And this was probably about 92 or thereabouts. And what happened was, I'd made plans to go with a bloke called Graham Bennion and Tim Bottomley, mates of mine. And what had happened was Warren Harrison and Howard Whittaker had gone. I'd suggested that they should go and fish it. And they went the previous summer. And I told them about this spot that I'd heard off a bloke called Bob Henderson, where Joe Taylor used to fish. So I filled him in with all this sort of hush-hush information. They weren't really geared up for it, Howard and Warren, for fishing on a water of that size. So they've got a little tiny sort of joke dinghy and, you know, inadequate gear for fishing there, really. But they went over and they had some absolute chunks out. And I was like thinking, oh, Jesus, why didn't I do it myself rather than pass the info on to my mates? You know, I should have done it first. But my wife had got, we got our daughter and she was a baby. So, you know, it's like when you've got a kid and you're thinking, oh, I can't really just go fishing. And my missus was giving me a load of shit saying, oh, you're fishing again, are you? What about me and us? And, you know, we need a holiday. So I kind of, the only way I could get there was to take them. And it kind of balls all my plans up, because you don't want to be taking a missus and a newborn baby with you when you're fishing on a place like Orient. But I was that desperate to go, I sort of thought, oh, I'll just bullshit my way through it. So I was just about to set off and my car broke down. So Tim Bottomley agreed to jump in with Graham Bennion in his car, and I borrowed Tim's car, and then he gave me the bad news that he'd got a Ford Sierra that he'd lost fifth gear or fourth gear, it was one of the gears, the top gear. So I'm going over in the Sierra with the baby in the car and my missus and with all the kit. And the car screaming its balls off because I couldn't put it in top gear for the whole journey, you know. So I was scared it was going to break down again. Anyway, we get there, and my missus says to me, where are we going to stay? I says, well, we'll get you an apartment, and I'll just fish. And then we'll go for day trips and things. I says, what we'll do is I'll find out when the fish are feeding. And I says, if they usually feed at night on these big waters over there. So I'll fish at night, and then in the day we'll go sightseeing. And even though I didn't want it, I wanted to be fishing with the boys 24/7, you know. So then the thought suddenly occurred to me, I thought, shit, what if the fish are feeding in the day? I'll have to fish in the day, we'll have to go sightseeing at night. Anyway, basically, I couldn't find anywhere for him to stay, and we ended up going everywhere. And I got this, all I could get was this apartment, and it was like a... It had all beds in it. It was like a dormitory in a lunatic asylum. So I got them a room in there, which was hideous. And I went fishing. I was stressed to hell. And we got settled and I got fishing. And then they kept wanting me to take them out. And I was, you know, having to wind the rods in. And I was fishing at long range, found some spots. And we were near these two Dutch guys. And they, one of them works on the North Sea oil rigs, and Jack and Hans, and he was an expert diver. And what he was doing was swimming out with his rigs attached to a... He'd take one run at a time with a rig attached to his belt, a diving belt. He was diving out and going down in 30 feet of water and placing his rigs on the bottom and placing hemp around them that he'd got all tied around his waist on bags and doing it perfect. And he had a 59 pounder like that. I was interested in what they were doing, and they started having them, and I thought, there's nothing I could do because I'm not that good of a swimmer, you know, to go down in 30 feet of water. And this was at Giffermont, I think it was. And anyway, I seen that the hemp was working, so I got some hemp with me. So I went out and did four rods, and then we got a massive storm came up, and basically it was like, it was like a hurricane, really. You know, we got all this floating weed. Have you ever seen that stuff that's like candy floss and it knits to your lines? It was just a nightmare. It pulled all my lines together, and I was fishing over a giant weed bed, fishing at about 250 yards out. And this weed bed had shifted, so we were getting false bleeps all night, and all the rods were off the rests and everything. It kept having to replace them. It was a hurricane force wind. And then it suddenly died down. So I'm in the dinghy clearing off my lines. About this weed bed went out about 100 yards. So I was clearing all the weed off and all this candy floss stuff. And then all of a sudden, my line pinged out. One of my lines was going off at a mad angle. I mean, a right angle. So I'd had a bite without even knowing it. So I grabbed the rod and went out. And then I realised that I'd not got the landing net with me. You know, in the heat of the moment, you sort of panic and, you know, you've got a fish up. So I'm playing this fish, and I was screaming to the lads to come out, but I'd got the only dinghy we'd got between the three of us. So I'm playing this fish, and it was one of them. I got it off the bottom, and there's stumps around, and it was slamming the rod down, and it pulled the whole of the rod down and the reel under the water when I was trying to stop it getting in these stumps. And I was hauling it up, and it came to the surface, and it was at least 65 pounds, this fish. It was a big mirror. And it was a colossus. It was absolutely probably a 70 pounder, and it was me one bite that had come like that after 3 days. And I'm in the boat, had it near the surface, going mad with no net with me. And I was thinking of trying to get my arm round it. I got it up, and I thought maybe I can get my arm round it and lift it out. Anyway, Jack and Hans came over with a landing net in the boat, and it took one last searing dive and went down. And then I tried to stop it, and the hook came out of its mouth, and it was gone. anyway, I couldn't believe how I felt. You know, it's one of them moments where you just, your head's in pieces. I felt like crying. So I went back to the bank, wound the rods in, disappeared to the local bar, and absolutely pissed as a rat. I was so depressed, you know. And it was just one of them times when you think, why is life so cruel to me? And then my wife's on my case saying, right, we want to go out now, we want to do this. And I'm like, oh no. And they got no more chances. That was it. Just the one bite on the session, lost the monster, you know.
Not good. Sick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're going to actually have a listener on to ask his question, but it appears Mark and Technology are in the recycle bin.
It's not even in the recycle bin, but. No, so I'd actually know Scott, who came into the shop today after he's asked a question on the Carpcast fan page. Uh-huh. So thinking, I'll record him and get him on. So I quickly stuffed my iPhone in his face and said, speak. After about the second or third attempt, we got it down right. And I've lost it.
So, well.
Apologies, Scott, but you might even be relieved.
Yeah.
I've got your question here, so we're going to answer it anyway for you.
Go on then.
So we know carp like salty food items leading up to spawning, and we also know that they eat snails, prawns, etc. What do you think of using fresh cockles, whelks and mussels as bait, which have a naturally high salt content?
Yeah, do you want me to go?
Yeah, is it something you've dabbled in?
Never have done, but we know they eat prawns. And how different can it be? They're saltier, smellier and fishier. So I'm 100% know that they will catch fish. I mean, Holmesy spoke about kind of stalking with those things. I'd certainly be happy, you know, float fishing or free lining it in front of a carp's face.
Speaking of flat cat as well.
Speaking with John Mack as well, I mean, John Mack's caught a lot of fish on dry roasted peanuts, straight out of the packet, KP ones. So
did he have heather on one of those?
Allegedly. Allegedly. He's definitely did catch fish at the car park on it, and many other places, over a few grains of hemp, you know, like two halves of dry roasted peanuts. So I see no reason why you wouldn't catch on those. You know, I know people have had the insides out of swan mussels and stuff. I mean, we know carp break swan mussels open to you know, to yam the welky looking things out the middle,
the slime.
Yeah, so without doubt, 100% yes, you will catch. I mean, I don't know if it's anything to do with the salt content, as opposed to it just being like a live gooey bit of natural. You know, should we be looking for stuff with extra salt? Maybe, but I don't think it's the salt it specifically. What about you?
I don't know. I don't think it's the salt specifically, but it's one of the things that it certainly doesn't do any harm having the extra salt content. And I have actually used cockles in the past.
Have you?
Trip to the local fish market, pick a load up, straight down to the lake, and I caught eels. I have caught carp on them as well, to be fair. But I think any lake where you've got nuisance species, you know, bream, eels, tench, basically any fish is going to attack them. So, like you already mentioned, I think as a stalking bait, they are brilliant. But for anything else, you know, just, you know, baiting up and sitting and playing the waiting game, you know, your bobbins are never going to be still.
It's something I might try, actually. Thanks, Scott. But yeah, I do think it's, you know, especially if you're fishing a carp only type lake, that sort of thing could get you a bite off a tricky fish for sure. So
yeah, definitely. If you get a big, aren't swan mussels a protected species? So you're not really supposed to go digging them out and murdering them all and sticking them on a hook.
I'm not sure. I mean, the lake that's featuring on the In Session, which we'll go back to in just a sec, I mean, that lake is full of them. They're all around the edges. They're everywhere, and they're massive, you know, size of your hand.
I bet the swans love them as well.
Yeah. Well, how did they get their name, swan mussel? Do you know? Do you know anything about them?
I know absolutely nothing. I know they hurt when you stand on them, when you're paddling around.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, actually. We'll do some research for the normal Carpcast, I think. We'll research swan mussels and come back.
Here's a bit of a history question for you. Did you ever watch the very first series of John Wilson's Go Fishing?
Probably.
And this is where my infathomably good memory comes into play. Because the final of his 6-programme series, he was carp fishing. A small lake, I don't know where it was, but it had quite a lot of fully scaleds in. Now, he cut one off the top at the end, but he had a couple in between, and he was scooping his landing net in the edge, collecting swan mussels, looking at all these tiny carp fry. We had to show you him prizing one of these mussels open, float fishing it, and catching one that way.
We know carp love them, and I've broke them open on lakes in the past. Can't ever remember actually catching on one, but there's not many lakes I've fished in years that have got them. But like I say, this lake we've been fishing recently on the In Session, yeah, that's it. In fact, let's go back there right now.
So we both decided that we'd redo all our rods 8 o'clock this morning. We'd redo them all and try and get our heads down. We'd both fill our bellies, get a breakfast, and try and get some sleep, which is what I did. I got all 4 rods sorted out. You did the same, didn't you?
Yeah, I got all my rods sorted out. I mean, by now it's become clear that mine is a complete nighttime spot, so obviously not getting no sleep the night before, it was a case of put the rods out, try and get some sleep. If tonight's going to be anything like the night before, you're going to need your kit. So we both did that, didn't we? Just got our heads down.
Yeah, by the time I got my rods sorted and made some breakfast, it's probably 11:30 a.m. You were still spotting, I think, when baiting up again when
Yeah, I decided to put the last of my bait in this morning, get it all in, get in bed, and then get me kip.
So at the back of our mind, like, we're getting this action, and we can't kind of say this is going to happen every time we come. We'd like to think that it's a really well-stocked lake and this is just the norm and we're going to have it, but in the back of your mind, it's what if we come back again and it's not like this and we're scratching for one bite? So you kind of have to, even though we're exhausted and tired, you have to keep on keeping on, don't you? Because we might not get this again.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, you don't know. I mean, it's all right. If you go to a lake and you know it's a heavily stocked lake and every time you go, you get a dozen takes, you know, it's quite easy to not fish a night or to think, oh, I've had enough, I'll not recast that rod because I've just had a fish on it and I'm tired. But we just don't know that. You know, it might not be as many fish as we think in there, and it might just be that they're localised into an area because it's winter time, or there might be loads of fish in here. But the bottom line is we don't know, so it's best to fish on, fish through it, keep going, and it'll just, you know, it'll all come clear in the end.
The spot that I was getting all the bites on at first, like, I had four or five bites in a row on that 6-foot spot, and just you know, like 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, I said to Roger, I'm reeling in one of my other rods and putting it on that spot. And the first thing he said to me is, right, you're not having any sleep then, because the action was that prolific that to put two rods into that area. But like I say, if I knew this was going to happen every time we came, I might have reeled in after the 5 a.m. fish and made sure I got 3 or 4 hours sleep so that I could fish effectively today. But we just don't know. We can't take it for granted. And also, you know, the lake could be fishing its head off. And there could be a couple of 50-pounders. I mean, one of the rumours is a 56-pound common. We don't know if the fish is still here. You know, we have it on good authority that's possibly been caught. But we don't know if it's still here, but the next bite could be a 56-pound common. And that, to me, is, I don't care if I've had no sleep, we kind of have to just carry on.
Yeah, it's enough motivation to chuck it back out.
yeah. Normally, if I'm getting ridiculous action on a run's water, I get to about midnight normally. If I've had a load of takes, I do what's called butt-ringing them. That's every time one of the rod goes, it gets butt-ringed. Hook goes around the butt-ring and it goes on the rest and it doesn't go out till I wake up. And that's old age, maybe, and laziness, but I haven't got that ability to just fish right through the night. If you know, the second you lay your head down and beep, 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 off it goes again. It's great, and like, you listen to this going, you're mad, I'd probably be sat up there hauling them all night. But when you're sleep deprived and you're as lazy as I am, it's hard to do. But that motivation of the, you know, the next bite could be a 50 pound or an unknown one that's not been caught yet, maybe another upper 40 50, who knows. We can't take anything for granted. We've just got to fish to the best of our ability constantly. But we got the rods back out about 11:30. I did, phone battery died, which is handy because I managed to get some uninterrupted sleep, and I fell into a deep sleep. And then I got woke up at 3 p.m. again, which is when the action started yesterday. 3 p.m. I got a screamer again, the main 6-foot zone again, where I've been having all the takes off. And this was a decent one, second biggest fish of the session. It was about 33 pound. I came up to see Roger. He was fast asleep. I shouted him a bit and he didn't wake up. Oh. Ooh. You just had that's Roger's right hand rod that's just beat there. And
yeah, just had a tench on that one, actually.
You just had a tench, yeah. Roger's had quite a few tench. So that first night, I mean, even though he had 4 carp, which was enough action, you had a few tench as well.
Yeah, I've had to deal with tench as well, so it's not only been like a bit of a trauma having to, you know, getting bites and recasting. I've had to deal with most nights I'm getting a couple of tench before anything happens. I'm getting motionless bobbins all day, no bleeps, no liners, no nothing, and then you know, sort of 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, start to get a few liners, a couple of tench, and then it seems like I start to pick the carp up. But getting back to what you said, your fish today when you walked up to me, is that the one where I said it better be big, otherwise I'm not getting out of bed?
Well, he didn't wake up at first. I came up, I shouted him a couple of times.
I was knackered.
He didn't open his eyes, so I thought, I'll go back down there, it's in the retainer sling, I'll let it recover and I'll redo the rod, get the rod out, put it all out, got everything right, made a brew, and then come up. And he was actually awake when I came back the second time. No, I had to wake you up again, didn't I?
He still woke me up.
No, yeah, shouted you. And that's what he said, if he's not big, I'm not coming. And I was like, oh, it's 33, which does qualify for
definitely big enough.
For getting out of bed. So yeah, we took a photo of that. Did I have another bite not long after? The one that I lost on the tree.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Yeah, so...
We sorted that out. I came back to mine, then you got another bite, didn't you?
Yeah. Same rod again. Or one of the two rods that's now over in that area.
Same area.
And the fish... Oh, no, I was in your peg, and it screamed.
Yeah.
I ran down. The fish had run about 20 yards, so it was like 24 wraps out, and it's probably gone another 20 yards. That's the other beauty of this lake, actually. And these fish haven't been caught a lot. I mean, some of them have been caught, but I'm sure not all of them have. And even the ones that have been caught haven't been caught enough to change their habits, because I don't think the lake's been pressured enough for them to change their habits. So what I found on lakes where... they're pressured a lot. The fish don't give you screamers. When I was a kid, every bite used to be... we used to use backwinding reels in them days, but we used to call them churners. And every bite was a churner. It'd scream off and the reel handle was backwinding at a million miles an hour. And when you fish more pressured lakes, the fish don't do that. They tighten up usually. You know, your bobbin tightens to the top and they might take a couple of clicks off the reel and, you know, kite into the nearest weed bed. They on here, they're all churners. Everyone from the first beep is just screaming until you get to the rod. And I'm just up the bank a little bit in Roger's peg if I've come up to, you know, get a brew or whatever, and I've had a screamer on the receiver, and so the fish has moved maybe 20 yards and I've wound it in. It's now on a long line, it's kited. There's one snag in the whole lake near me. And it managed to find it, and I ended up losing the fish. So I've redone all the rods since then. Roger's redone all his, spotted up. It's now dark. This is our last night. It's, what time is it? 7 o'clock maybe, 7 p.m. Roger's had his first tench, which starts the night off. It's kind of the start of proceedings for him. Luckily, I've had no tench at all. Mine have all been carp. I mean, I've had 9 bites, I think, in 24 hours. In the first 24 hours. I think I might have had more than that now with the one just before dark. I think I've had 10 in total now. And we're on our last night. The weather's cooled off a bit tonight. It's going down to 1 degree, so there is going to be a frost. We've filled our belly with Indian and a couple of Budweisers, and what we really need is a kipper to finish off what's probably one of my most epic sessions in 30 years of carp fishing.
Yeah, we definitely just need the icing on the cake now. And to be honest, I've got a feeling it's going to happen. You know, it's just coming into what we'd probably call my time for my area. I've had that tench, I've had just a line about a second ago. I'm feeling really confident. Your area's just been super consistent since you started, so...
It's weird, isn't it? The first 24 hours, nothing, and then it just kicked. But it is going a bit cooler tonight. I've just spoke to my missus on the phone, and she's actually said I could stay another night if I want. So my choice is, if I stay another night, I'm probably not going to get a pass to go fishing next week. But if I come home in the morning, I can probably get back on Monday and fish another 3 nights next week, which, I mean, that's more fishing than I've done in ages, and it's January, but we're on to something special here. In
session. So we'll check back in for the final bit of the in session in the non too distant future. We like to cover 2 topics really for stories in the Carpcast Extra. As I said, we try and make these as long as possible, a bit of a marathon edition. So, we're going to do scary story, we said, don't we? Can you think of a time you've been scared or uncomfortable or something supernatural's happened on the bank, Mark?
No. It's the honest but useless answer. There is only one time where something weird has happened. And, well, I think it was substance-induced, so we'll not go there. Let's just say I've never touched anything since, as you well know.
Yeah, you got spooked out by the nasty weed or something.
I'll tell you the story.
Go on.
I generally don't touch this stuff because, you know, a couple of puffs and then that's me, I'm asleep. You know, it doesn't really do much for me. So nothing against it. If people want to puff, fair play. So I'm having a social with a fella on pit two again, and he rolls me one, and I thought it's rude not to, and I don't know what was in it. I don't know one weed from another, but wow, it blew my head off. So after three small puffs, I kind of nipped it out of sight and politely made my excuses and went to bed. And woke up some hours later, and it was literally as if someone was, well, basically just pounding me, but I could not move. Really horrible, strange sort of trapped feeling. And then I kind of like woke up full consciousness, looking out over the lake. Of course there was no one there. It was just very, very strange. I was up for the next hour, drinking coffee, just like thinking, what the hell just happened? Walked around to the other fella's swim, he was snoring away like a good un. And walked around my bivvy, there's nothing there, there's no footprints, no one's been anywhere near me. So I just thought, right, that's it, I'll just stick to coffee and Jaffa cakes.
I tell you what, a not too dissimilar story is something Frank told me.
Have I ever been scared while I've been fishing? Yeah, I've had a couple of things. I had one. I'm dead psychic, mate. I don't know if you've ever heard about this. I have all these premonitions and weird stuff. I've always been like it since I was a small kid. I've predicted captures with pounds and ounces before it's even happened and filmed it. And said it and filmed it. It's weird, really freaky. But I used to have a fishing tackle shop in Altrincham, and we had a series of events that happened there. I won't go into detail, but I never believed in ghosts or anything like that, or spirits. After I had that fishing tackle shop, I know so. I've seen it all. I've seen stuff moving in front of my eyes with all the customers. Remember Billy, that used to be an HDV driver from Withinshaw? He was in the shop one time, and we felt a cold blast of air on a summer's morning. There was three of us in the shop. We heard a sliding sound, like something shuffling. We looked round, and there was a Terry Eustace rucksack slid across the top of this fridge freezer, flew 20 feet and hit me. Then some bags came off the wall. He said, "I'm sorry, Frank." He says, "I've got to get out of here." He had a 40-foot Arctic outside. He ran, left all his gear that he was going to buy on the counter and took off, and never seen him from that day to this. We were watching stuff moving, proper moving, and that was the tip of the iceberg. I had all sorts of weird stuff happening there, terrifying, and we had to get out of there because of this. Anyway, at that period in time, I went fishing on reeds, man. I was down the shallows, right? And I'd been off that lake for 10 years, and I'd just got my ticket back and went on there. And I was fishing down the shallows. I'd had two fish just before it got dark, fishing on the far side under the snags. And it got dark, and it was a strange night. I had this weird nightmare. And in the nightmare, I had this really vivid dream of a car on fire with somebody screaming trapped in the car. And I woke up and I was sweating, and it was probably 4 o'clock in the morning. I felt uneasy, like I was being watched. Anyway, I woke the other two guys up that were fishing nearby and said that had they heard anyone moving around or seen anything. Anyway, they hadn't. One of them was Alan Williams, I remember it. I went and got back under the bivvy, got on my bed chair, and was laying there thinking, it's weird, it's like I'm being watched. I was really restless and uneasy because of this bad dream I'd had. Next minute, I thought a tree had fell on my bivvy, because it felt like my bivvy had collapsed, and I was pinned to the bed chair with a weight on my chest, like someone was on top of me, suffocating me, right? I'm awake. The pressure was that much, it snapped both the cams on my Fox bed chair and forced me back to the floor. I was starting to scream and fighting, trying to press off whatever it was that was over me. The two lads come running down, seeing that the bed chair was all snapped and everything, and there was nothing there. And the bivvy wasn't down or anything. It was like I was being suffocated with somebody on top of me, a presence. It was terrifying. Anyway, check this out. I started talking to Alan Williams, and I told him about this weird dream with that as well, because I was so shook up by it. He said, "Do you not know about the Commodore?" I says, "What Commodore?" He says, "From the yacht club, Brian." I says, "No." he said he'd had some repairs done on his car, a Volvo Estate. He was driving it from the yacht club down past the shallows, and his car set on fire. So to try and extinguish the flames, instead of just getting out and running away, he drove over to try and drive it in a lake in the very swim I was in, and burnt to death in the car. And I didn't know about any of this. So that swim to this day is now called the Nightmare Swim.
Wow.
Yeah. How strange is that, eh?
That's a spooky story.
Mm. Yeah, it is. All true as well, every word of it. Another time I'll tell you about what happened in the shop. It goes beyond belief. It's absolutely terrifying. Actually, I will tell you a little bit. I got out of there years. There was somebody else got the shop and was having it renovated, completely transforming it. And I was walking past that shop many years later, and there was two guys working on it, and they came out and they recognised me, and they're both carp anglers. And one's called Martin White, who's from London originally, and he came out and shouted, "Frank, what are you doing down here?" I said, "I just took my lads for a haircut in the local barbers." He said, "Have you ever seen what we've done to this place since you had it?" I says, "No." So I went in and they were showing me around, and they were both members of the syndicate at Lower Capesthorpe. So I was passing the time of day with him, chatting a bit of fishing and stuff, you know. And I couldn't help but say it. I said to them both, "Have you ever had anything strange happen while you've been working here?" "Because it's haunted. We've had all kinds of things moving." He says, "We've seen stuff that you can't even believe here happening." And I says, "I knew it." And guess what else? He says, "When we were digging the footings out in the old cellar," because it was 200 years old, that place, he says, "we dug under these cobblestones, right? We dug underneath to check the footings out to make sure everything was, you know, solid. They found a coffin buried under the floor that had been there for God knows how long, a wooden coffin with something in it, and they just concreted it in." Yeah, how horrible is that? Yeah, something bad's happened there. Something very bad's happened there. It was horrible. It's spooky as hell. I didn't believe in anything. I'm not religious. I don't believe in anything, or I didn't do, but I do know that there's something that we don't know about now. It's another, I don't know what it is, but it exists, and I've seen it, and some of people that I'm very close to that have been in that shop, they've seen it as well.
Big thanks to Frank once again. He's a great storyteller. The Nightmare Swim, spooky goings on, he's got it all. And Andy's Tackle Shop, a member of his tackle shop, many, many years ago in the Altrincham, Manchester area. If you're here, you would know. Yeah, spooky stuff.
Yeah, what about you, Jamie? Have you had any spooky occasions on the bank? Has anything shook you up, made you scared, run for cover?
I don't think so. I can't think of anything obvious. I remember when I was a kid and, you know, we weren't supposed to be night fishing and all that. I mean, night times are always scary when you're like 14, 15 or whatever, just being out in the dark. But that was what was magical, is what made me love carp fishing to this day. It was those, you know, magical nights. The nights seemed to last forever and they were all spooky. You know, nothing specific happened. I remember a burglar alarm going off over the back of one of the fields once, and late we weren't supposed to be on. I was dead scared in case there was a burglar hot-tailing it across the field right into my bibby. But, you know, that was about it. You were more scared of bailiffs and getting caught. And, you know, it was... I mean, when you're young, you do hear noises, don't you? A bit like you do when you're a kid in your bedroom. You see the shadows in the wardrobe and they look like figures and, you know... all the trees and stuff when you're on your own in spooky places, but it doesn't really get you when you're older, does it? So, touch wood.
You mentioned that burglar alarm. That has just reminded me of another occasion from years back. Yeah. Have you heard of Tyra Mall Syndicate?
Yeah.
Well, it's not always been a syndicate. We used to night fish it years back, you know, before the current owner got it. And just literally less than a mile up the road is Lindome Prison. And just beyond that is Morland's Prison, which is top security. And there's a friend of myself fishing there one night. And there's quite a lot of light pollution around the area anyway. There's a housing estate in between the prison and the lakes. And this particular night, you know, there was sirens going up the road. There's lights flashing everywhere. Before long, there's a helicopter going over with the lights everywhere. That something had gone over at the gone on at the prison. Of course, everything's going through our minds. We're stuck there until his parents pick us up, thinking, "Oh my God, there's a murderer on the loose. He's escaped. He's going to hide out in our bivvies." But never did find out what exactly happened.
There used to be one of the main, was it Broadmoor over the back of Yateley? The alarm used to go off at, it was either 10 or 11 every morning, probably still does, like the, you know, the warning alarm. So if you ever hear that in the middle of the night, you've probably got reason to be scared, because I think they were all in there, you know, the high profile ones, your Peter Sutcliffe, Yorkshire Rippers and all them. Broadmoor was the one where the main psychos are. But yeah, you don't want to be hearing that go off in the middle of the night. It was bad enough at 11 a.m. Let's go to should we have another good storyteller, Ronnie de Grota. Have you ever been scared whilst fishing?
Yeah, once.
Okay.
Not because I was fishing, I was casting, but I will tell you why. So have I ever been scared whilst fishing? Yeah, once. in the early 90s. So Saddam Hussein has...
cart ruts?
Yeah, Saddam Hussein with the Gulf War, Kuwait, and so on. So the Americans that helped the Kuwaitis, and so on and so on. So as Saddam Hussein said at one certain moment, he said, every power station and so on around Europe is a possible target, you know, to bomb or whatever, to do some terroristic attack and so on. So I was fishing the Campus Canal, and the Campus Canal, there is a power station. So to cool the power station, they take water from sluices, stretch 4-5. So they cool the power station and they put it back into the Congo, what we call the Congo Canal. And it really looks like, you know, the Congo wild, a lot of, you know, it really wild, a lot of trees in the water, very lovely place. And then it comes back, the Congo Canal comes into the Campus Canal again between sluice 6 and 7. So... And so we go back to the early 90s. So that was the period of the first Gulf War. And of course, in those days, we. And the other thing is, on the other side of the Congo Canal, there was a big lake, something like 100 acres or something like that. Mm. So we were really believing that the Belgian record was living in that area. And for one part, we were right, because my friend has caught, you know, one of these three big fish there, and one of the those big fish became later the Grote, the Belgian record cup that I caught. But anyway, it was still not at that top weight when it was living in that stretch from 6-7 Congo Canal to the big lake. Of course, I was casting there quite regularly. And I was quite good in that. So I was sleeping just on a ground sheet, so even in the winter. So in the winter, in those days, it may freeze 10 degrees. The water temperature was between 10 and 15 degrees. So that was brilliant. Now you can't have these water temperatures anymore, as there is a law on thermal pollution and so on. So they are not allowed to put that hot water again into, you know, into the river. So anyway, in those days, 15 degrees water temperature, perfect temperatures for big carp. It was winter, so all the carp moved into the Congo Canal. They did not really come to the Campus Canal then, to that stretch 6-7, so they were in the Congo Canal. So I'm a hunter, so I like to fish where they are.
Yeah.
So you guess it. I was not allowed to fish there, so but I was casting.
Yeah.
As you say it so beautiful in English. Of course, we had to do it very... quiet. We had to do it with a limited tackle. So I only had a ground seat, a sleeping bag, two rods, rucksack with some, you know, with all my tackle and bait in. I was in one swim, I had baited it up. So we had to bait it up in the dark. So we had to arrive in the dark. We had to leave just before sunset, you know, before. And there was, of course, as it is a power station, there was a control with guardians and so on. So I was fishing it, but because of that Gulf War and because of that power station, which is, you know, an important thing, there were also soldiers controlling the lake. One night, my rods were standing in the water, you know, hidden a little bit, one rod left of the swim, one another rod right of the swim, very close to some overhanging trees. I was laying on a ground seat under some bushes, you know, in my sleeping bag. I heard some soldiers passing by, and they were really passing by at the distance of between 7 and 12 meters, about 4 meters above me, and they were shining with their flashlight. And I still do not understand why they did not see my rods. But it's very remarkable. I guess that they did not feel themselves very comfortable themselves. And it's very remarkable that people who do not feel themselves comfortable in the dark, you know, they don't see anything.
Yeah,
it's like people has passed by me at 2 meters, and I was just standing next to a tree, and they did not even notice me. If I had jumped from behind the tree, you know, they had filled their pants completely. So anyway, so I'm laying there on my ground seat in my sleeping bag, and they are shining with their flashlight over it. But you have to understand, they are soldiers, but that means in this period also we had our military service. So we were 18 years, and we had to go into the army for 10 months or a year, depending.
Yeah.
So it's over now. I don't know how it is in England. But anyway, in Belgium, you don't have to do it anymore. It was quite possible that a kid of 18, 19 years were walking with these soldiers, you know, around the fence to do their control and so on. So I was not afraid about that. I was not afraid about being there, because I knew that I was not supposed to be there. But I was afraid that I said, look, if I got a take now, the moment they are here, they are shitting themselves.
Yeah.
They are shitting. They don't know what happens, because suddenly a bite alarm start to scream. So I'm sure at least one fills his boot, his boots by his pants. Yeah. And what will he do? He has bullets in his gun, so he can start shooting. And that's why I was scared. I was not scared because I was fishing there, or that I was not supposed to be there, but I was scared that somebody else was scared and that he would start shooting in my direction if I got a take when they were passing by. So yeah, then I said, you know, as soon as they are gone, so they did, I don't know, every hour or every 2 hours they did that too. I said, as soon as they are gone, I pack my my stuff and I go home, and I don't come back before that Gulf War is finished and everything has calmed down a little bit. So that was, in fact, the only time I was scared.
We want to hunt, but we don't want to be hunted. We don't want to be shot in the dark.
No. Well, but the thing is, imagine what happens.
I can picture the scene.
Yeah, you're 18 years old. You are not very comfortable in the dark, but you have to do to guard the power station. You have to walk in the dark in the forest. So you are not comfortable. Then suddenly, something about 7-8 meters from you, 10 meters from you, start to scream. You see some red or blue or green, whatever kind of light flashing, and you see one kind of idiot coming from under the trees trying to stop that carp. You know, then you know,
you're going to shoot it.
I would shoot first and then ask questions, you know.
It's wartime, 100%. Yeah.
Well, I have been in war situations when I was fishing in Africa, but that was a war situation also. And that was, I was afraid, as I said, not because I was be there and not supposed to be there, but because I was scared that somebody else was scared that would do me something wrong, you know, with a bullet. And that, you know, with all respect, but no cop is worth a bullet for me.
No. No.
Right. My scariest story on the bank was when I was fishing in Belgium the year before last. I was fishing in what's called like a dog walk, like a swim that is fenced off from a dog walking zone. And it's got a gate to prevent the public, the dogs coming into the fisherman's area. And I was fishing in this zone, and I decided to padlock the gate just because I didn't want anybody to come in. So I put my bicycle chain around it, and I was sitting there, 25 degree sunshine, sitting there in my pants, drinking beer, didn't have a care in the world. And then all of a sudden, I just heard, in a foreign language, it didn't sound like Flemish or Belgian. And I looked round, and there's this guy stood there, and he's like dressed head to toe in a Marnie, he's a skinhead, and he's shouting in this accent, in this language that I've got no time for. And I thought, I wonder if he's a bailiff and I shouldn't have locked the gate. Maybe I'm in trouble for locking the gate. So I've gone up and I unlocked the gate, and he's still talking, and I'm talking back, trying to communicate. And he said, English. I said, yeah, English. And he said, I don't talk the English. He said, my friend will be here in a minute. He talks English. And I was like, right, okay. And I remember looking at him, and he had like these Armani trousers on, like proper shoes. He was driving like an old banger. And he then said, do you want a cigarette? I said, no, I don't want a cigarette, mate. And then his mates turned up with like a bag of this, like, looked like homemade alcohol, some hooch stuff. He goes, try some. I was like, no, I don't want none of that. He's like, no, try some of that. I was like, no. He said, do you want to buy some drugs? I said, no, I don't want to buy any drugs, right? And then they're like, in between time, they're talking in their own language between themselves. And it turns, and then they start telling me that they're from Chechnya. And I've got, at the time, I didn't have any idea where Chechnya was. But I've the only time I've ever heard Chechnya mentioned is on the news, and Chechnya rebels and people getting killed and stuff. So immediately I'm thinking, who are these weirdos trying to force feed me drugs in my swim? Anyway, bearing in mind I've been on the bank for 2 weeks at the time, and I've not had a shower. One of them, the first guy, came in my bivvy and sat next to me on my bed chair, and I'm sat on my pant, in my pants. And I'm thinking, this is not good, right? It's not good. He's looking round my bivvy and that. Anyway, he comes out and he walks behind the bivvy so I can't see him. So I'm looking at his mate thinking, what's he doing? But luckily the vents on the back of my bivvy were undone. And he put his coat down and he started praying on his coat, like bending down and doing his bows and that. And I'm thinking, this is not right. And I'm thinking, what can I do in this situation? They're obviously going to try and rob me. This is because they're asking questions like, who are you with? Where are they? Are they going to be round here soon? And stuff like that. It was not paranoia. There was definitely something going on. They were feeling me out to give me a kick in and take my stuff. And I was like, oh, my mate's down there. He's just around the other side of that port cabin. And he'll be up here in a minute and stuff. And I remember I pulled out the only thing I had was a butter knife, right? I'm talking the stuff you eat your dinner with. No point on it whatsoever. And I'm thinking, right, I'm going to stab the fat one, and I'm going to dive in the lake, and I'm going to swim to the other side. They'll never catch up with me. I've only got my pants on. I'm thinking like, they won't be able to hurt me if I'm out in the lake. And one of them said, I'm going to go to the shops to get some more alcohol. Do you want any again? And I was like, no. And he went, and the first one I could see, he was sort of standing there all itchy feet, and then his phone rung. It was clearly the other guy that had just left, and he'd obviously say, look, we ain't going to get nothing out of this guy, he's got people around. And they left, and I remember that night, sitting there in that swim, absolutely shit in my pants, and my butter knife under my pillow, thinking it's all I've got to save me.
was that the swim where you ended up having all the fish from as well?
No, at the opposite end of the lake, yeah.
That'd have been the signal if it was the going zone and you knew you had to be there, but it was a little bit dangerous.
It's just a real experience sitting there in your pants and then someone questioning where your friends are, where they're going to be, and these dudes are from, they're both like 6 footers and one of them was quite meaty, and I'm thinking, there's no way I'm going to fight both of these off, no way in a million years. So I'll stick one with the button and I can go for a swim.
And these guys back at home in Chechnya, I mean, obviously, it's for those that don't know, you know, it was a former Russian state that had civil war with the Russians, and these guys used to sleep with Kalashnikovs under their pillows, you know, not butter knives. So when they come over to the West, and then, you know, maybe they're poor, got nowhere job, and they're just looking at us as easy targets, you know, and we wouldn't know how to fight a geezer that's been brought up, you know, as a baby with AK-47s. I mean, that's a scary situation, you know. Life's cheap where they come from.
Yeah, exactly that, mate. I'm a fisherman, not a fighter.
Wow, what a position Daryl was in. It's reminded me, actually, there's a couple of times I felt unsafe on the bank, and one of them was a Northampton lake, Delapri it was called, and lots of Polish around the lake. I did actually have two rods stolen off there, my marker rod and my spod rod, lent up against a bivvy. I'd woke up in the middle of the night and I could smell smoke, you know, like I could feel, I think I woke up because I could feel somebody behind me in the bivvy. And I could smell smoke in the air, like cigarette smoke. If you're a non-smoker, you can really smell that. And it was some silly o'clock in the morning, 3, 4 o'clock, something like that. And I listened for ages, like dead still. I always carried, like, I won't say what in case we get locked up, but I used to carry a defensive equipment on there. And I remember having it in my hand, thinking, there's somebody here, I can feel it. Anyway, I ended up drifting off back to sleep after a bit. When I woke up in the morning, my spod rod and marker had gone, and I ended up looking up the bank, and I found the braid that the marker was attached to. Well, the marker was there with about 2 foot of braid, and it had obviously been cut, and there was all oil up it. So I was clearly somebody had was on a bike, and they'd got the, you know, the marker dangling off the rod. They'd got it caught up in the chain. It had snapped it.
And, I hope they fell off.
Yeah, so did I. But yeah, there was somebody there in the middle of the night. I always felt unsafe on that lake. I never slept an easy night. There was a car got burnt out in the car park next door to mine. Although I believe it is a lot more secure in the cars now, because you have to come in through a barrier now. But I was speaking to somebody at the angling show the other week, and they were saying that. They've been fishing there, and they were saying that it's still a bit like that. Still a lot of Polish on there. They spin for the carp, and you know, they cook fish up on the side of the lake and stuff at one end, and it always felt a bit intimidating on there, and never enjoyed it. And I suppose that's the only time. Did I feel scared? Yeah, I probably did. Probably counts as a scary story.
You're certainly concerned.
Yeah, it's nothing worse than being there. You're quite vulnerable, aren't you, at night on your own, and you know, with thousands and thousands of pounds worth of valuable equipment that people want to steal. So
this is what makes me think about all this urban banks trend. You know, I can't think of anything worse, personally. Some of the places where, you know, credit to Alan and his crew for going and fishing them, but not my choice. You know, you don't know what sort of drunks and dropouts are going to be wandering past.
Yeah, I mean, when we asked Alan Blair about his scary story, he didn't really have any, except for that time in Amsterdam when it was just the sheer volume of people and drunk people and stag nights and stuff that are around. I mean, he hid himself away. He said he always blocks himself in with his van, usually, wherever he is. But he said he didn't really sleep there, although he didn't really have any other scary stories. So he's not on this bit, but, you know, he's got a point. But we're getting very long here now, so I suggest we start to wrap this up. We've got two left. Who do you want?
Yeah, let's go for Kevin Nash next.
Is there ever a time where you've been scared on the bank?
I don't scare easily. I think it's because I'm stupid. Yeah, I haven't got enough self-preservation. But yeah, the one that comes to mind actually is the one I wrote about in Memoirs of a Carp Fisher, when me, Phil, Harper and Zen and Boko on the snake pit, and we got this weirdo regularly visiting our swims for a couple of days, and you know, his behaviour was started somewhat untoward, and then when he started having voices in his head, you know, he's all dressed in camouflage, and you know, saw him peering out through a bush at me with a knife, you know, we decided to get off there and go to Harefield. And then a week later, Zen rang me up, he's reading the local paper, he'd been talking by the way on the lake about voices in his head and this woman's name. Zen's reading his local paper, this guy's on the front page, he's murdered his mum, and she's been rotting under his bed while he's been with us over the snake pit, and the voice in his head was his mum's name. That was quite interesting.
Yeah, that's going to put you on edge. No supernatural occurrences. You've never heard the invisible person creeping through the bushes behind you.
I've never heard of that, and I don't think I believe in ghosts and whatever, but I do believe in, for example, ESP. I really am weird that I can think or talk about someone and they contact me.
And their phone goes.
Yeah, the local friends. Yeah, that's understandable. Yeah. There's so many stories. You know, for example, when I was on Harefield, there's a guy on there. He's called Bill the Lily. He made a living out of cropping lilies. And I was telling someone a story. This is 15 years since I'd last seen him over Harefield. And when we was over there, and the police turned up and said, "Have you seen Bill?" I said, "Not recently." I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, we're investigating the lake where he's nicked all the lilies." And I was telling someone this story, and then the phone rang, and it was him.
Yeah, you know, for the first time in 15 years.
Yeah, and I can tell you so many stories like that.
I completely. I mean, I'm not one to not go through the not conspiracy theories, but you know, I'm open minded to things that we don't understand, and I don't mean supernatural, but I believe our brain gives off electric signals.
It's the same with carp.
Yeah,
I'm one of these people who is never packing the rods away and like laying them on the ground and get a take. It's never happened to me. Yeah, mm. I'm one of these people where, you know, it's going to happen, you know, and I'm willing it to happen. It never happens. I get all my action when I'm either making a cup of tea or on the phone. In fact, when I was chasing that man of Biggin, I knew the problem I had. You know, you can feel it, you can hear me, that I actually went and grabbed a book out of my rucksack and just got halfway through the front page when I got the take. Yeah, I really do believe that carp somehow sense I'm in their proximity. You know, there's nothing to do with noise and that, because I'm so stealthy. But as I say, number.
And you think they transmit signals to each other as well? You think they kind of talk to each other?
Like, I don't think they transmit. I think they talk. Absolutely, absolutely. No, they do. Yeah, and again, as I was writing memoirs, I wrote about the resin, where a method worked right up to the winter when we stopped fishing. We'd gone over there on June. It was blowing. Yeah, and I've seen that several times in my carp career. And it wasn't until we got this place that I started seeing things. Mm. And you know, this is my thing, crazy.
Just getting
ready,
Kev.
This is my theory, as crazy as it's going to sound, right? In the season, summer, spring, whatever, yeah, they're moving around, singular or the odd one or two together, right, and say we're catching them, blah, blah, yeah. Come winter, they all group up, and we've seen the groups, and it's stunning, they almost go into a ball. If a lake's going to freeze, and I've seen this on the office and the cops, they are in a ball, the whole population just a foot, 2 foot below the surface, and they're slowly moving through each other. You know, first we're thinking, well, they're keeping warm, well, they can't be keeping warm because they're cold-blooded. Then I realised it's down to motion. They're doing that so the lake doesn't freeze, right? If the temperature's dropped too much and it does freeze, we've also noticed that suddenly holes in the ice appear, and there's ice sitting on top of the ice. They've actually crashed their way through. So yeah, they're trying to deal with the danger of the toxicity, the gases building up, right? And this is my theory. When they come together and group up in winter, into the, you know, they're all together, that's when they're passing the information and talking about their experiences. And I genuinely believe it. I think we are arrogant if we believe animals can't communicate. Yeah, from a fly to a fish. I was watching a documentary a couple of months ago, and it was about prairie dogs. And this guy was researching them, and he put their call onto a computer. The call sounds identical, right? Mm. But when he got put it on a computer, he could see all these different peaks and troughs, right? Well, he's turned up at their colony with a, I can't remember the exact list of animals, but he had a bear on wheels, right? They've made this call, he's gone all down the colony, and he's got it on his computer, right? He's then done it with coyote. They've made exactly the same call. He's put it on his computer, and the peaks and troughs are all completely different. In other words, he's identified that a prairie dog can recognise the difference between the various threatening predators and tell the rest of its mates there's a coyote coming or there's a bear coming. Yeah. So we're really arrogant to think animals can't communicate as well as we do.
I was going to mention documentaries. I've seen, I'm nothing as specific as that prairie dog story, but I've seen many documentaries over the years when they're usually danger, it's a signal of danger, and they're conversing, that they're letting the rest of their pack or the other, you know, species know that something, there's danger. And I mean, we're danger to the fish, aren't we? When it's, so if one gets caught and you put it back in and it swims past the others, you're telling me it doesn't let them know it's just been caught.
But the whole point of that prairie dog thing was, for me, not the fact that that could communicate danger, it's specifically communicating the type of danger,
different types.
So that's conversation, simple as that.
And I've always believed humans can do it. I mean, I know exactly what you mean about, you know, just feeling that it's not a coincidence when you think about that person you've not seen for 15 years and then all of a sudden you have a contact with him. I mean, I don't know why it happens. A bit of me thinks, like, he was going to ring you and you felt the fact that he was going to ring you. It's triggered a memory from you. Like, the fact that he's gone, I'm going to ring Kevin today for whatever reason, and he's... Or is it the other way around? Is it that you've relayed a story about him and he's picked up on that somewhere in the universe?
It absolutely is that.
Definitely happens.
That was just one of dozens of examples I can give you where... everyone in the office knows it. I'm talking about some... And then... Within 12 hours, they contact me. What? I'm called the witch around here. It just.
I think you have to be open to it as well, and it happens more. I mean, I don't question it. I've had that since I was a kid. Like,
doesn't go the other way though. People don't say, "Oh wow, I was just talking about you." It's, you know, it seems it's me gets them to contact me. You know? And I've also tried. I'm going to win the lottery this week. That don't work.
That's the key one. Yeah, and I have had it the other way. I've lost count, it happens weekly where I speak to somebody and they're like, I was just thinking about you, that's weird. You know, I do get it the other way, but the best example I have of it is one that everybody can relate to is, if you, I mean, I've done this, I've been in the entertainment late night industry for 25-30 years, and I used to have this job where I worked in a sound and lighting place. We used to hire DJs the equipment, and a lot of time you'd have to go and collect it at the end of the night. So I could walk into a bar, a club, a working men's, whatever it is, and everyone's gone. Like, there's just the staff there cleaning up, and there's the DJ packing his wires up, and I'd be going in there to fetch the gear. And I knew if he'd had a good night or a bad night by the feel of the room. You could, atmosphere lingers in a room. So you can walk into a boozer where there's a load of meatheads and it's about to kick off. You can feel it when you walk in. You can feel that there's a bad atmosphere, just the same as you can feel when there's a good atmosphere. And I think that's electrical signals given off by the brain. I think we pick up on it. We're tuned to do it. And everyone's walked into a bar and they go, it's moody in here, let's get out of here. It feels a bit...
Yeah, I think we don't really understand the potential power we got. Yeah, it's like the one, a kid, is trapped under a car, suddenly the mum has got the strength to lift this car. It was only, it's in the last 10 years that I began to realise that there's pockets of perfume in the air with the trees. I'd walk down, oh, that's a lovely smell, then walk back and it's gone. The pockets of perfume sit in the air, but then you walk through and they're dispelled. And then from that, I started to smell carp. I think I wrote about it in Carp World, thinking, thinking about carp talking, communicating. They're going to think I'm raving mad. But yeah, but once I latched onto it, and there's been at least six times when I've walked around a lake and I've smelt carp. Whether they've just rolled or whatever, I don't know. But four out of those six times, I've had a bite within 10, 15 minutes and put the bait out there. Yeah, and so I think there's so much once we can achieve it, if we can open our minds to it.
That's the key, is opening your mind. And I think the more open you are to that sort of stuff, the more it happens, because you're allowing it to happen, you're not questioning it. I stopped questioning things when I was young. I just allow them to happen. And yeah, I'm glad that you're on that same wavelength, because I've had conversations with people that just don't understand what I'm talking about. And I've had conversations with many people the same as we've just had, where they know exactly what I'm talking about, and they felt the same thing.
Oh, so well, Jamie, we get it, mate.
We get it. I'm hoping that I get it as well as you one day, because you've done it.
It went from a scary story into a pretty deep chat, which is one of the reasons why I love talking to Kevin, because he just goes off. I mean, I talked to him for hours on that particular day, and most of the great stuff we didn't record. Lesson learned to leave the recorder going all the time, because we go off at tangents when we talk. But I mean, it went into complete communication of species of fish, animals, and almost ESP telepathy type thing, which is not scary, but I find that sort of stuff really, really interesting. So once again, we've got plenty more of Kevin Nash to come in future Carpcasts and the next Carpcast Extra, but I do love his stories. Let's quickly check back in on the In Session.
In Session.
So it's 11 p.m. on the last night, the longest period I've been without any sort of bite, and I was just saying goodnight to Rachel on the phone. Just got in my bag, it's gone really cold, and it's forecast to go down to zero, kind of 1 degrees tonight, so it's going to be frost. But I just lay there saying goodnight to Rachel, and I hear Roger's buzzer go. He's got his fourth rods on, like his snide buzzer, which is just a dead old sort of Fox MX turned up to high tone, so he can hear it, because it's not like his normal ones on the receiver. So I can hear it from my swim. It's his only rod out of the four I can hear. It screamed off, and so I wandered up there, and freezing cold, and just to see him with a little plump mirror, about 22.5 pound, which is... I mean, his action normally starts at midnight, as we said before, and it started at like 11. Even though it's cold, I mean, it's not the sort of night I want to be up all night with multiple takes. It's a bit of me hope, while we want the action, it's a bit of me hope that it slowed down a bit tonight. I'm quite happy to wake up for, get some 4 or 5 hours sleep and wake up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning to a screamer and land a lump. That's the idyllic situation, but... In reality, Roger's probably just had the start of what's going to be another night without sleep. I mean, I don't want to balk myself. I don't want to tempt fate for it not to happen. But it looks like we're one fish closer to that 50. It's 4 a.m. on our last night. Just been awoken by the usual one toner. Quite a slow one. A few of the... Above the 30s have been slow takes, so it was steady, just churning off, and hoped it was going to be a big one. Came in pretty easily, really. It's absolutely freezing cold, everything's white. It's amazing what 24 hours can do. The night before I was getting activity all night long, super mild, and everything, the bivvy's white, the unhooking mat or the cradle's white. Tops of the rods, it's gone down to 0 degrees, I think, and it certainly affect the fishing. I mean, it's flat calm, it's like a mill pond, it's not a ripple anywhere, it's just very silent, as you can hear. And then the fish just came in a straight line, just pumped it back, shook its head a few times, and it was quite a pretty 20 pound mirror, fairly typical to the fish we've been catching, all the same strain that we've seen so far. nice to catch a fish. Didn't want to go too far behind Roger tonight because I've, unless I dreamt it, I've heard his alarm. I dreamt I heard somebody walking up to a bivvy, I'm not sure. Maybe check and see if I was awake for a picture, but I don't know if I dreamt that or not. We'll find out in the morning. But I'm sure I've heard his alarms twice since I've been in bed, so it's a good chance he's had a couple. But yeah, it's another one. I mean, it's chalking another fish up to an epic session. But this is the least amount of action I've had in the last 24 hours. I mean, I think the last bite I had was about 4, 5pm, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning. So I think the target now is just try and get another one before we leave, about 11am. I've just found that I can't come back next week. I've got something else on which I'd completely forgotten about, which kind of changes things a little bit. So we'll have to see.
So what a fantastic session that's turning out to be. It was, you know, one of the best, one of the biggest red letter days I can think of in recent times.
Yeah, that's a good winter session, a good summer session around winter, January.
Yeah, end of January, yeah. I mean, absolutely cracking session to finish up with that many fish. Couple of 30s. Yeah, it was fantastic. We were allowed to fish it till the end of March. I'm not even sure I'm going to get a chance to get back on there now. I've got a hell of a lot on in March, but maybe we'll see. But rounding this to a close now for another Carpcast Extra. Once again, we do thank you for supporting us. And should we? Who have we got left?
We've got, for the spooky stories, John Mack.
Let's get John on.
Okay, so a scary story whilst I've been fishing you're after. Now, I've got a few. I've been fishing enough times to have encountered a few scary situations. But I've got a weird one. I've got various ones. Yeah, I mean, we've all been there, haven't we? We've seen the pumas, haven't we? I mean, you know. But yeah, I've had weird blokes. I've seen pumas. I've had weird blokes. What think I have? I've had weird blokes walking into me swim in the middle of the night whilst I'm standing there talking to a mate and, like, have a pee against the tree and then stand there looking at the tree and he hasn't moved. He's, like, 6 inches away from the tree looking at the tree. I've had all of that. I've had weirdos like that come up and then and walk off and, like, just weird things. But the weirdest thing is another time that I was down the railway. This is absolutely unreal. I can't tell you what it was, but I'll explain it, and you can make your own judgement. But I pulled up, it was night time again, got down the lake late, stopped off, saw Ted in the corner in his camper, went down to the far end, down by car corner, no one's there, pitch black, turned the lights off, turned the engine off, and like, became aware, obviously, when you're driving and you pull up in front of something like bushes or trees, you've got your lights on. Things in front of you are lit up, aren't they? So, you know, I turn my lights off, turn the ignition off. I'm sort of like looking around in the front of the cab of the van, and I'm aware that the whole cab of the van is lit up, and there's no light on. I look out the window, and I'm out looking out the driver's side window up in the sky at sort of, you know, up there, like high up and sort of just to my right, and there's a bright white light there. And I was calm, I wasn't scared, but as I saw it, I knew that it knew I was looking at it. It was a weird thing, and it kind of just, it was quite large as well. It's quite large, and it just sort of went in on itself, and it just went out. It wasn't moving. It just went out, and it just closed in on itself. And then the cab went dark. And I looked back into the van, and it was dark. I just thought, well, you know what? That's be a UFO. So, anyway, went and set up. Wasn't worried because I didn't feel threatened or anything. It was just a weird thing, but I knew that it knew that I looked at it, and it knew there was some mutual thing going on there, right? Anyway, so I went and set up, and the next day I went round to see Ted. I went, hey, Ted, I went, mate, I said, listen to this, you're never going to guess what. He went, what? I went, I saw a UFO, mate. He went, what were you on about, you idiot? I went, well, I just told him the story, what I've just told you. So we're sitting there, and I told him the whole story, and he's cooking me a bit of breakfast. He's got his radio on, and Kent News or whatever it was came on or whatever, and you know, they do the news, and then at the end they had a little bit of a thing, and it said, you know, last night there were dozens of reported sightings of UFOs in the Kent area. However, we've spoken to the meteorological office, and they say that there was a meteor storm. So nothing to worry about. And I just thought, I looked at him, I went, gobsmacked, mouth wide open. There you go. See? I told you. I said, hang on a minute, let's get it right. I said, he went, see, it was an asteroid. I went, no, mate. This thing was not moving. It was stationary. It was there. It was looking at me. And I looked at it, and it closed in on itself, and it went out. Now, how weird is that?
First of all, the news confirmed it, and secondly, it confirms that the news is full of shit, because they tell you what you saw. You know, I mean, how many people wouldn't really know the difference and probably just go, yeah, that's probably a meteor shower? But we know as anglers, you know, we've seen meteor showers, we've seen big orange asteroids light up the sky. You know, if you spend a lot of time outside at night, you see stuff like that, and you know the difference.
Yeah, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, and all the time, you know, it's that typical almost a cover up, like well, just the news trying to tell you what.
It's laughable, because people are going to go, "What an idiot! He has he seen a UFO?" But I weren't stoned. I weren't on anything. I was stone sober, you know, totally stone sober or whatever you want to use. And they said, oh, there was a meteor storm. Like you just said, though, meteor storm, you know what they look like. They're shooting through the sky. They light up the sky. Yeah, I've seen it all. Been out there thousands of times and seen it. But I've never, ever seen something like that big, there, glowing, bright white, lighting up the cab. And then I look at it, and it just goes in on itself, and it just goes out. No spaceships shooting away, or aliens with green heads or anything stupid, but that was an unexplainable, weird situation. So there you go, that's that one.
And you felt a connection with it, the fact that you felt it connected with you, it knew you were there, you knew it was there type thing. I mean, that's something you can't explain.
Yeah, it knew that I was checking it out, sort of thing. But do you know what, afterwards I thought, maybe they were checking me out, you know. I don't know.
I love it.
I love that story from John. Maybe they were checking me out. He's absolutely brilliant. And how could you not believe him? He's just the way he tells it. I mean, without going into UFOs, the amount of time we spend on the bank looking into a dark sky, you know, quite often in the middle of nowhere, I have hoped I would have an experience like that at some point in 30 odd years fishing. You know, I mean, I don't want to be took up to the sky and anal probed, obviously. But, you know, as somebody open to the fact that, you know, we're highly unlikely to be the only planet supporting life in this universe. And, you know, we're discovering stuff all the time. We're going to be visiting further and seeing further with telescopes and God knows what. So, yeah, I just think it's really interesting.
I think that as soon as Zefrin Cochran discovers warp drive, I think the Vulcans will find us.
Without doubt. That's a nice way to end this. I'm going to say thank you. Thank you for listening. If you've made it this far, 3 hours into the podcast, then we applaud you. Let us know, as usual, what you think of this. And then we're going to sign out with the session, I think.
In session.
So Roger's all packed up. His gear's on his fancy electric barra right behind me. Last morning, did you have any fish? I heard your alarm go in the night. It woke me up at some point. What happened?
Well, basically, we both went to bed
after our Indian and a few beers, feeling really confident. I think I had a tent while you was there, didn't I? Which is exactly the same as nights before. Went to bed, thought I was going to get, you know, the fish might move in the early hours. Had another tench, managed to re-chuck that rod, and then I got a third tench, which, you know, the nightmare of all nightmares happened. Ended up trying to pull it in between my rods. It tangled up all three rods. I had four rods out, so the three rods that were left out, it tangled all them up. So I had a tench 2 foot from my rod tips, connected to all my lines. Basically, I had to get out, get my waders on, sort it all out. You know, it did cross my mind to actually, oh, I'll just leave, you know, wind my rods in and go to bed. It got really cold, but I persevered, re-chucked some more, thought the carp gods might reward me. Then cut a long story short, real quiet night, hard frost, nothing's happened. It seems like the lake switched off, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's one of the plus sides of a shallow lake, is it reacts quickly to warm weather, but it seems to have switched off just as quick. I mean, I had the one bite in the night, which again was slow. We had 4 each the night before, didn't we?
Yeah, we had 4 each the night before, one for me last night, plus the tench. You've had one overnight as well, haven't you? So yeah, it's obviously switched right off. We woke up this morning, there's frost everywhere, everything's severely frozen. So I'm having a quick wrap and I'm out of here.
This is definitely a story to be continued.
Yeah, definitely.
The Carpcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk. Look at me.